Support for Boston Public Radio comes from Eastern Bank. Eastern Bank is committed to helping people and businesses prosper, investing over $240 million in local charities since 1994. Eastern Bank. Join us for good. EasternBank.com. Member FDIC. And M&M Skylights, located in Stoneham, installing and servicing a wide range of Velux skylights that can help bring air and more natural light into your home. You can learn more and schedule a skylight consultation at mmskylights.com.
Ahead on Boston Public Radio, some of the Mueller people tell the New York Times their report is far more damning for the president than the AG suggests. But has the public already made up its mind? We'll talk to Chuck Todd about this, Congressman Richie Neal's push to get Trump's tax returns, and more. Then we open the lines and ask you if the Mass Gaming Commission should just say no to Wynn Resorts. Now that they've fessed up to covering up allegations of sexual assault and misconduct by Steve Wynn, should the state yank its license and deal a new hand, or is it better to slap them with a steep fine and let bygones be bygones?
At noon, Andrew Cabral is here for another edition of Law and Order. Then Senate President Karen Spilker talks about her push to bring gender equality to all with her Gender X bill. That's next on Boston Public Radio, 89.7 WGBH. Eastern Brody, I am Marjorie Egan. You're listening to Boston Public Radio, 89.7 WGBH. Nice head shave, Jim, for cancer. I admire you for doing it.
Well, it was actually a great day. We'll talk more about that in a little bit. Thanks, because I want to get to Chuck. In a new book, longtime sports writer Rick Riley chronicles how President Trump is a serial cheater when he plays golf, saying, quote, he cheats like a mafia accountant when golfing. He cheats crazy. Well, we also find out if Trump cheats like a mafia accountant on his taxes. Yesterday, the chair of the House Ways and Means Committee, local guy Richie Neal from Springfield, asked the IRS for 6 years of Trump's personal business tax returns. Trump says he'll take the fight all the way to the Supreme Court. If he does, could he stall everything until after the 2020 election? And does the public care? Joining us for his take on this and other headlines is Chuck Todd. Chuck's the moderator of Meet the Press, which you can catch Sunday mornings at 10:30 on NBC Boston. He's the host of Marjorie's second favorite, I think, show, I hope, Meet the Press Daily on MSNBC, and the political director for NBC News. And he's the host of the new podcast, the Chuck Toddcast. Hello there, Chuck Todd.
Well, good day.
Oh, my goodness.
And to you.
Another podcast from my extensive library. This is very exciting.
I you know, the hard part of podcasts, I will admit, is being a listener, because you can't listen to three at the same time. You know, right? You know, it's like you can't like quickly scroll through. It is one of those things. There's so many good podcasts and not enough listening hours.
That is true. That is true. That's why you have to take long walks, because that's the way to listen to when you're taking 6 to 7.
Hey, I got one good Trump golf story. Good Trump golf story. It's so my pals over at NBC Sports, one of them told me, and I don't want to say who it is, but basically this one of the executives is basically was obligated to go golfing with Trump once or twice a year. And because NBC Sports and golf and Trump locations, you know, it is, they had to do business with Trump World. And he says every Trump golf outing ends the exact same way. You always gamble. If he's winning, he'll finish 18 with you so that you can pay up. If he's losing at hole 14, he gets a call. Got to go. Can't finish. He'll always pay. I am told he'll always pay. I don't know if I would have won or lost, but I'll go ahead and pay, but I got to go. He never, every single time, this person has golfed with him nearly a dozen times, and about half the time, he left early, and every time he was behind.
It's a great,
every time.
Great story.
The golf book is one of the greats. The anecdotes out of there are absolutely a riot.
Can I just tell you?
Yes.
There is the greatest character test, because golf is self-regulating. You can find out a lot about somebody's character, because the only person who's making sure you follow the rules is yourself. It is a great character test, and I have no doubt, put it this way, I'd never golf with Donald Trump, because I would not believe it was be on the up and up.
Well, you know, one of the great quotes in that, in a story I read about the golf book, I'm not sure it was in the book or just a quote about it, was from the late Arnold Palmer talking about how he would never – Arnold Palmer's dead, isn't he?
Yeah, he's dead.
Yeah, I thought so. Just to double check. That he said he would never make a business deal with someone he hadn't played 18 holes of golf with, because exactly what you say, you see true character on the golf course. I love that. So I think that we –
Well, you know who else won't play with Trump? Jack Nicklaus, because Trump is better than Jack Nicklaus, obviously.
Right.
So why should he?
I mean,
right. Why should he play with him?
So
well, he's got 18 club championships. Trump.
Yeah,
does,
that's
know.
All at his own courses.
Nicklaus doesn't have that.
What a coincidence. So Chuck Todd, back to Richie Neal. It's kind of ridiculous. We call Richie Neal Richie Neal. He's a senior citizen.
I love
now.
That
that's how he goes.
Call him that. That's what Buck. Of course, you Bostonians got to call him
okay.
Richie.
Okay, well,
he's
Richie.
Always Richie. And it's like you have Eddie Markey, right? Eddie. He's not Ed. He's Eddie.
Okay.
And Lindsay, right? Lizzie Warren.
No,
right,
we do sorry. Not call her Lizzie Warren, but thank you very much.
Well, anyway, Richie, as we know, is from Springfield. He's a chairman of the Powerful Ways and Means Committee. He's going after the president's taxes. So what is going to happen? I mean, as Jim said in the opening, the president could take this fight all the way to the Supreme Court. But, of course, it's fairly regular for presidents to release their taxes. So this president is unusual in that regard.
He is unusual, but it was always a voluntary exercise. For what it's worth, right? It was it's done. Ironically, Nixon started started it as a way to try to, I think, negate this idea that he was on the dole or whatever. He had his own nefarious reasons why he did it, but it became a tradition, unlike any other. If we're going to sit here and do golf metaphors, and so now they're trying to get it. I will say this: I think number one, I think there's no doubt in my mind that the White House strategy, while the Democrats have subpoena power. An executive branch has slow rolling power. Okay. So every request, whether it's the Mueller report, whether it's tax returns, whether it's security clearance forms, I promise you the White House will be dragged kicking and screaming before it complies until a court of law. So I expect every demand, every request to be slow rolled by this administration. It's basically the one tactic they have. I will say this. I think Democrats need to be slightly cautious on this. Using the power of the federal government to demand somebody's tax returns, politically, I get what they're doing. But if it looks like you're using an arcane to go after a private, there's a line where you can get backlash here where it looks like you're invading personal space. The president has never produced proof that he's under audit. So, you know, hit him on that, maybe do those things. I will just say this. I think there are going to be some Americans who will, as much as they don't like Trump, cringe at seeing the power of the federal government used to grab something that we're not necessarily supposed to have out in public. I think there's a line there. Just be careful.
We're talking to Chuck Todd. Chuck, can we move on to the people I call Bobby Mueller and Billy Barr, if we can, for a second?
Yeah, Bobby.
So here is the headline in the New York Times. Everybody's talking about late last night. Someone Mueller's
Bobby
team.
By the way, they would call him Bobby Three Sticks. Robert Mueller III, he'd be Bobby Three Sticks.
Got it. Anyway. Got it. Someone Mueller's team say report was more damaging than Barr revealed. Yeah. How big a deal is this?
I'm shocked that there's gambling going on in this establishment. I mean, this is the most predictable story. I feel like we talked about this when it came out. That, hey, the report's not come out, but the spin's already out there. It's, you know, once we see the eventual truth, is it going to matter? And now we're seeing people on Mueller's team who never leaked, for what it's worth, despite all the accusations that came. They were not leakers, slowly expressing frustration at what Barr did. It's exactly what it looked like Barr did to a lot of us, and now that's the accusation out there. By the way, I talked about the slow roll. I don't believe we're going to see this full Mueller report ever. I don't.
Why?
Or at least not in this term.
Why?
I think you're going to see Barr believe an expansive view of what the Justice Department should release and shouldn't. And I think that he will redact a lot more than Congress would like to see. And I think we're going to have this fight between the Justice Department and Congress overseeing the rest of this report, probably for the rest of this calendar year. And I think it's exactly the way the White House wants it, even if it eventually comes out.
But on the other
hand, make it look like the Democrats are only focused on the process of getting it out. it will politically mute the impact of it even more, just the way what already Barr has already done has muted whatever impact now that any summary that says, hey, the president wasn't exonerated and the only reason we didn't do it was X, you know, that's already been muted.
But, you know, when you read the New York Times story, and you're right, it's very predictable. You could expect that people would be upset about the Barr taking the short little summary that he did and exonerating the president, at least on the collusion.
Not one complete sentence.
Yeah.
One complete sentence is in the Barr memo.
But we do learn in this report a couple of things, that the Mueller people had written several summaries, which they claim, these complainers, that Barr could have used. But the second thing is the fact that they've already expressed their frustration, whoever these people are that were on the Mueller team, leads me to suspect that if we're heading toward the election and there's no Mueller report, there's going to be more leaking. Because their reason for complaining is that they think that that Barr has misrepresented the thrust of their report.
Yeah, but before Chuck responds to that, I think the key line in this New York Times story, with which I agree, is it says, because Barr created the first narrative of the special counsel's findings, Americans' views will have hardened before the investigation's conclusions become public. I think that was the strategy here, wasn't it, Chuck Todd?
I completely believe that was the strategy. Now, it's possible that views are going to be hardened anyway. Okay, it's possible it wouldn't have mattered. But I think definitely that's going to be the case now, that no matter what it's said in the report, he'll always have that he didn't find any crimes, right? He'll always have that, which is enough for Republicans to hang their hat on for now. They've made that decision. And anything else is just going to be seen through partisan eyes now, even more so. So I think that's what that's probably the best way to look at this, is that what Barr has successfully done on behalf of the president is make sure the Mueller report continues to be seen through a partisan prism. That had it all come out immediately and you'd seen the case for obstruction basically laid out without a conclusion, it's possible some Republicans might have been persuaded that the president broke the law. But now that Barr has put his stamp on that he didn't, even if someone else interprets it differently, I think we're guaranteed that this is a partisan prism that we now view Mueller.
You know what? Well, I'm viewing him through another prism. I almost see him now as the too much of a Boy Scout that may have gotten snookered. I mean, he prepares several summaries.
I've been concerned about
that we all talked about the highest of integrity. Well, maybe his integrity is a little bit too high, because I think he got outplayed by the Attorney General. And in some ways, I feel shame on him for not anticipating that.
You know, this is the line, right? And this is the line, this ethical line, I would say ethical dilemma that the Trump era has presented a lot of people, which is you see Trump always breaking the rules or breaking norms and being willing to do whatever it takes to survive, whatever it takes to get through a news cycle, whatever it takes to get through a bad story. And you realize he's not playing by the rules. And you sit there, and on one hand, if you want the rules to be respected, you want to make sure you always play by them. And you hope that over time you're exposing your other side that isn't playing by them. But you're right. This does, and I worried about this the whole time, that essentially Trump and his team used Mueller's integrity as a weapon. He weaponizes Mueller's integrity against him. You know, they leaked all the time. Mueller didn't, but accused them of leaking. You know, Mueller couldn't respond, right? Because he never was going to respond. He literally responded once to a news story, once, that BuzzFeed story, and that was it. I've always thought that it's possible that in the Trump transactional, where there are no rules, literally there are no ethical boundaries on the right right now. On somebody, there is no. If somebody can find one that Trump will respect, please tell me. There's none over there now. And I think that essentially Mueller, I think, yes, Boy Scout, all those things, and I understand why he did it, but I'm with you, Marjorie. I think his integrity was used against him, and I think now he was just outmaneuvered.
We're talking to Chuck Todd.
He wasn't willing to break the law.
So, Chuck Todd, I'm obviously, most of America has seen the Wayne's Worldian video of Joe Biden yesterday, 2 minutes long, explaining that he gets it. Mm-hmm. He gets how times have changed. Did it do the trick or did it not?
I think it, well, it depends what the trick was supposed to be. I actually think the trick was not about convincing millions of people, hey, this, you know, I get it. If this was about Biden convincing the core group of people that he's trying to get to work on his campaign not to get cold feet. I think with the purpose of that video, and I think he successfully did it, was to erase any doubts that this was going to chase him out of the race. Mm-hmm. He's not getting chased out of the race. That's number one, and that's crystal clear to me now. I didn't have, look, the way they didn't respond over the last couple of days, I think had a lot of us going, what's going on? Is he getting cold feet? Is he going to have second thoughts? The video, to me, erased that. Okay, none at all. Look, I thought the most effective part of the video was couching how the reason he finds himself physically touching people is he's always believed government should connect with people. Mm-hmm. I thought that was a very good explanation that you could come up with. Now, he didn't apologize, but I think it's clear Biden doesn't think he should have to apologize, that instead he looks at it that he will evolve. Let's see if it's enough. I happen to believe that this is a story that is getting a bit overhyped in the Acela corridor and in the activist wings of social media. And it's not nearly as much of a problem if you walk the streets of Iowa, South Carolina, or New Hampshire.
So, Chuck, before you go, do you know where your father was born?
I do.
You do?
I do. He did. I do. I mean, he you know, he spoke the native tongue of Waterloo, Iowa. But yes, I know where you're.
So, you know, just in 24 hours, I know you hate when I bring all this stuff up because it gets to issues that are unresolvable. They're working on the best health care plan ever. Actually, they're not. His father was born in Germany. No, he wasn't. His taxes are still being audited. No, they're not. I mean, is there? I don't even know what to do with this anymore. What
he
does...
lies so often? It's just like it's not a, and it's not even really. It's you know, it's so funny. It's just because he's trying to impress somebody in the moment. Mm-hmm. I mean, in that case, you know, so he's trying to prove that he doesn't, this is like, oh, no, I love Germany. You know, my dad was, well, you know, no, but it, by the way, his ancestors were, I think it's his grandfather was born in Germany.
Yeah, there's,
I mean,
there's somebody there.
Yeah, I mean, it's not wrong. He's of German descent. And I believe it was his grandfather who went and ran the brothel during the Yukon Gold Rush. No, I'm not kidding.
No, I know.
No, a hotel brothel and all that. And look, he was a businessman. You actually read the story of Trump's grandfather, and he was basically, you know, a guy just looking to make a buck like any other immigrant. I mean, and, you know, trying to set up a store, the Gold Rush, you know. It's actually a nice immigrant story.
You know, you probably don't know this.
The president ought to learn it. The president ought to learn it.
I'll give you something you can use on Meet the Press Daily. That brothel that his grandfather set up, Bob Kraft's grandfather went there. Did you know that?
Yeah. It was called the Orchids of Alaska, right? I think it was called
the Orchids of Alaska. Hey, before you go, very quickly, tell us about the podcast for those who don't know about it, Chuck Todd.
Because I am known for my dad humor. It is the Chuck Toddcast. I mean, we had to do that once. Here's the best way to describe it. I believe it'll be that it's attempting to have the conversation that we have during commercial breaks, you know, with my favorite reporters.
Oh,
and politicians, where
I like
it's a little,
that.
It's a little more, I mean, look, you guys know this. You guys are the great disruptor, to a conversation is the camera. You take a camera away and you're going to have a really cool conversation. I mean, you and I, you know, three of us prove it every week. I say this and I love my television show. Don't get me wrong. Well, we all know there is something that relaxes a person on audio.
Totally true.
And you just have a rawer conversation. You have a more straightforward, intimate conversation, and a little more one-on-one. So, anyway, that's probably the best way to describe it.
Great. Chuck.
That is a great point.
It is a great point and a true one. Great.
Yeah.
Chuck, good to talk to you. Yeah. Good luck with it. Talk
Thank
to you soon.
Thank you.
Thanks, guys.
Thank you, Chuck. Chuck Todd joins us every week. He's the moderator of Meet the Press, which you can catch Sunday mornings at 10:30 on NBC Boston, Channel 10 on most providers. He's also the host of Meet the Press Daily on MSNBC, which is a great show. And now he's the host of the podcast, The Chuck Toddcast, and the political director for NBC News. Up next, we are opening the lines and asking you about Wynn Resorts. Now that the company admits it's covered up sexual misconduct allegations against Steve Wynn, is it still worth taking a gamble on them? Or should their license be revoked? That is next on 89.7 WGBH Boston Public Radio.
Welcome back to Boston Public Radio. Jim Brady and Marge Regan. Kenny Rogers knew when to hold him, when to fold him, walk away, and when to run. Question is, does the Mass Gaming Commission, now that Wynn Resorts has admitted to covering up allegations of sexual harassment and misconduct by founder Steve Wynn, who's gone, by the way, should the Gaming Commission let the company keep its license or not? If you want to understand the extent of Wynn Resorts' cover-up, here's how one state investigator describes it. Their efforts at secrecy made it exceedingly difficult, if not impossible, for gaming regulators to detect potentially derogatory information through typical regulatory means. That's a quote. So if the Gaming Commission paves the way for Encore to open, supposedly in June, what guarantee is that they'll be able to effectively monitor the company's operations, given that deception has been part of their DNA? Of course, they say it's a whole new board, whole new team, all that sort of stuff. And of course, if it's if they deny the continuation of the license, that could mean a big business is not able to open, and there are lots of jobs that don't work. So don't happen. Is it, at least for now, is it worth yanking the license? Should the state be doing business with an operation like this? Should they just slap them with a huge fine? What should happen here? What should the commission do? Our number is 877-301-8970. I should say we're speaking a drop in the dark because we're relying upon news reports. We have invited the new chair of the Gaming Commission on the show here and on television. She said she'd love to come, but not until these hearings are over. So this is based on reporting we've seen. I have to say, based on what I've seen, I think Joan Vinocki in her piece nails it.
Yeah.
Can Massachusetts regulators trust Elaine Wynn? That's the wife, who, by the way, is the largest private shareholder, according to Joan, when she did not tell regulators what she knew about Steve Wynn's alleged sexual misconduct when the company's suitability first came under consideration in 2013. She basically lied to the regulators in 2013. If she had told the truth, the license may not have been approved to begin with. It was approved in part because of the lies and deception, and she's still the largest private shareholder. Can they be, meaning the regulators, asked Joan, believe Maddox? He's currently the CEO, who used to be Wynn's right-hand guy, when he insists he knew nothing about sexual assault and misconduct allegations against Wynn. Now, can I give you my analysis of this thing? And tell me if you think it's too harsh.
Okay.
And it may be. I don't know. So there's a sexual predator, sexual harasser atop the company. The company essentially lies to the regulators in Massachusetts. I think most of us agree the regulators would not have approved Wynn Resorts had they known about the extent of the misconduct and the payoffs. But they are okayed. Again, let me repeat. They're okayed because of lying and deception by those who ran Wynn at the time. So they now come back years later when the issue is, are they still suitable? That's a term of art under state law, to keep the license, and basically say, yeah, we lied. But one, we apologize. Two, we've cleansed ourselves, which I think is debatable, even though a lot of the board members apparently are gone. The takeaway for me is if they're allowed to stay, and I'm happy to be convinced otherwise, because there are a lot of jobs at stake here. There's no question about that. What it seems to me, the moral of the story is, if they continue to be approved, Marjorie, is when you're a big business that comes before regulators in the state, lie, cover up, deceive any way you can. If you have misconduct, that'd be disqualifying. Then you get your license. And then when you're caught a few years later, apologize for what you've done and fire a few people and say, we've atoned for our sins, we've cleansed ourselves. And by the way, if it turns out you take away our license, you're really going to be hurting workers and Everett, the community, all that sort of thing. I think this is a really dirty deal and is really troubling. But again, I'm willing to be convinced otherwise.
Well, I guess my question is, what's the alternative? Someone else comes in?
Yeah, exactly.
Okay.
Well, can I quote, by the way, somebody who I think is pretty bold here? Maura Healey, when she was with us a couple of months ago, she's with us last week, and we talked about it too. Here's what she said, which I thought was pretty bold from the Attorney General. Here's what Healey said.
The Gaming Commission should feel no pressure whatsoever. They need to do their job. They need to do it well and to do it right. And I don't care that a building's been built. the more important work and effort was to make sure that for this first go-round, and again, this is our first test of, in this new industry of a suitability analysis, that it's done well, that it's done with complete information, full information in the facts, and that's what the focus should be on.
You know, did you read Larry Edelman's piece, who I think is a former business? I don't know. He's,
I read a bunch of them. Oh, yes. The Wynn Resorts, time to find him $100 million.
And he says, you know, it's hard for me to say. I think he went on to say that Maddox, the CEO, has got to go. But you know, the argument I think he makes, and correct me if you think I'm being unfair to him, too, is, wait a second. There are a ton of jobs here. This is going to be delayed in court forever if the license, if they're found to be unsuitable to continue holding the license. No developer is going to buy the place from Encore Wynn, whatever it's called now. So it's the whole, it's going to be a disaster for years, which may be true. But the natural extension of what Edelman is arguing in the Globe, at least it seems to me, is then we have to basically say it's fine to lie and deceive and mislead regulators in the state, because later, you know, it's almost like a too big to fail kind of argument that we heard in 2008 and 2009. There are too many jobs. There's too much at stake for Everett and Eastern Massachusetts if we do our job and hold them accountable for what they did to us. You know, Elaine Wynn, I want to say again, the divorced wife of Steve Wynn, is, according to Joan, still the largest shareholder in the private shareholder in the company. She is the one who withheld critical information from the, and this Maddox guy, Maddox guy was the chief financial officer, said he knew nothing about the multi-million dollar payments to this woman that Wynn had sexually abused.
Well, we should say that their excuse is not totally ridiculous.
Which is?
That they saw this all in the context of a very nasty divorce between Steve Wynn and Elaine Wynn. So, you know, it's the ticked off wife theory.
What's her excuse?
What's Elaine Wynn's
excuse? A board member or
I'm not saying she's got an excuse, but I'm
Well, she's still the largest private shareholder.
I guess the thing with this to me is, what's the lesser of two evils? I mean, you're getting involved with casinos. A lot of people think right there you're doing something that's really morally questionable and increasing people's addiction to gambling, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. There's a long history of shady things going on at casinos.
So we just have to accept it.
Well, I'm not saying we have to accept it, but I guess what's the alternative? What is Everett, which is a town that could really use this revenue, are going to be faced with? I mean, and you know, what's really sad to say is that we have been so corrupted in this first term of the presidency with somebody, you know, we have a sexual predator running the country. We have someone that lies all the time. So it's really awful to say, but when I hear these things about a gambling magnate, I kind of think, you know.
Well, I don't. I have to say, and I agree that the president's conduct, credibly accused by at least 14 women, not to mention his own language or whatever the number is, unfortunately, it sets a pretty horrible standard. But there is no dispute. This is not factually in dispute. They lied and misrepresented to the Gaming Commission.
Does this mean they're going to have a white elephant sitting there for 5 years?
No, you know what it means? It means if your course, the place you seem to be going, and I understand lesser two evils, it's a practical argument. What you're basically saying, you are making a too big to fail argument. You're basically saying, even though they violated all the rules, even though lied, as I said, to the regulators here to get this license to begin with, because there's such a huge operation with so many jobs, with such tax revenue implications, as sad as it is, we have no choice. And by the way, you may be right,
but that is a pathetic state of affairs. And I grant you that their credibility is seriously in question. They claim they're going to be clean going forward. Now, that's a lot
Mike,
to
Mike, this Maddox guy was the chief financial officer when there were payoffs.
Right.
How competent is he to run the organization if he was the chief financial guy and didn't know that the guy who he was advising, Steve Wynn, who ran the thing, was paying $7.5 million.
Well, again, maybe we have plausible deniability in the Wynn organization like we have plausible deniability in the White House.
877-301-8970. The hearings are going on now, as you heard Henry Santoro say. I don't know how quick the decision is going to be made by the Gaming Commission, but I would argue it's a hugely important one regardless of where
you are. It is really important.
But,
just let me say again, you know, people in Everett have been counting on this. They've got this huge structure there that's almost built. They've got massive amounts of money coming to them for the schools that they really need. So I think you got to...
Well, here's what I would say, Marjorie. If you're right about that, and you may be right, and this they are found still to be suitable, here's what I would say if I was the CEO of this Maddox guy at the board meeting, at the next board meeting. Gentlemen and ladies, here's what we were just told by the Gaming Commission. We can do anything we want. We can break laws. We can lie. Because as long as we go in and apologize, after we're caught, what we are able to say is, wait a second. There are 4,000 people working in this casino. Are you going to put them all out of work?
But you know what? Unlike other entities that like the Wall Street people that get fined, it doesn't make a difference. Big-time fines could matter to them.
What's the evidence of that? They were fined $20 million in Nevada. What's the evidence?
Well, maybe you got to go to $200 million, $300 million. I don't know. At some point, I don't know the answer to this. I mean, you may be right and I may be wrong.
I don't know if I'm right
either.
But
I'm just pointing out the two sides of this story.
But you would agree that if it
were... The fact that there's sleazy stuff going on in casinos, I mean, I can't say that I'm shocked.
Marjorie, if this was a small business that had gotten a license and didn't have huge number of jobs or tax revenues in the exact same circumstance, you'd say, get rid of them, right?
It's a different story.
So their defense, according to you, and Edelman, to a degree,
it's not a is good, the, I'm not arguing it's a very happy defense, but I just think of in my hometown, which can't even elect a mayor here, that you know, where they've had two mayors recalled in a row, and they've got massive problems with poverty. They've got massive problems with everything. I don't know what's worse, to turn a blind eye to a lot of not turn a blind eye, but to give someone a license who maybe shouldn't get it, or to say to Everett, sorry. We promised you a lot of things and you plan a lot of things and now you're not going to get them because these are sleazy people out of Las Vegas.
Rob in Newburyport, you're first on Boston Public Radio. Thank you so much.
Hey, guys.
Hi.
Is this a story about some misconduct and lack of transparency, or is this a story, as Marjorie said earlier, about moral judgment about gambling? Remember, this casino was voted in during a deep recession, I think during the Deval Patrick administration.
Mm-hmm.
And it seems like the state's done everything it possibly can to prevent this from opening. And this is just another example.
Well, I don't think that, by the way, the state, for whatever it's worth, the state under Deval Patrick approved this. Sal DeMasi, a former speaker, wasn't crazy about it. But then we know what happened to Sal, and it sort of paved the way for this. Then there was a ballot campaign to repeal the gaming law, and the voters decided, no, let's keep it. I would argue, if anything, not only has the state not stood in its way, the state has paved the way for this. And I guess all I'm arguing, and again, I'm not at the hearing, so I don't know if it's as bad as it appears in writing. They have to do their job. There's a law that they're supposed to enforce. And as seedy as the industry is, which I guess is what you and Marjorie are both saying, Rob, rules are rules. And if it turns out there's some tax pain and some job pain to ensure that grotesque lying is not done to regulators, I think we got to live with it. But, I hear you. And sadly, Marjorie, you both make a point that this is not an industry that is sparkling clean. But I think we have an obligation to keep it as clean as we possibly can.
No, I was going to say this is a Catholic school, but I can't say that anymore.
No, you surely can. You cannot. We'll go to Brendan in the car. Brendan, you're next.
Hi, Brendan.
Hi there. This may be a little bit draconian. I'm kind of on Jim's side on this, and I don't know that you could do it. And I liked Marguerite's idea of like $200 million, $300 million, $400 million fine, something of that nature, as the backup. But I'm wondering if the state couldn't say, listen, you guys lied to us, lied to us, lied to us. You know what? We're just going to take the property by eminent domain. We'll run the damn thing ourselves, and everything goes to the public.
Well, I don't know if they can do it is the answer to your question. And I'm not sure we want state government running
state
a casino.
State officials, oh, my God, can you imagine what could go on there?
Well, except, in all fairness to Brendan's idea, we do have the – I hate the lottery, too, as you know.
Massachusetts casino.
We do have a state-run lottery
that
returns a higher percentage of its money that's bet to cities and towns than any in the United States of America. So despite your ridiculing government, Marjorie, from time to time – they have some good experience there. I'm not sure we want them in the business. Brendan, we'll ask somebody who does know that question, the answer to that question, and we'll let you know. Or maybe we'll ask the Attorney General when she rejoins us next month.
Of all the brother-in-laws that could be hired at the blackjack tables, Jim.
Well, I'm You don't think they may be hired anyway? By the way, if you want to stay on top of this story, Craig LaMalt, our colleague, is at the hearings, and he is doing great work there. And I think it really matters. I mean, this matters a lot. It says a lot about our state, what the ultimate outcome is, and why the outcome is what it is. So follow
Craig.
You
know what it also says? The difficulty of getting a straight story, even with all this investigation going on long before they came here, you know, that's really depressing too.
Well, except one of the issues, without getting lost in the weeds, why was the Wall Street Journal able to uncover information, I think it was in 2018, that our own state investigators were unable to uncover? I mean, why?
Well, you know, great reporters for the much-hated media. Well, maybe, those great investigative reporters.
Maybe that's it. You know, but
Wall Street Journal is a great newspaper.
I go back to exactly what I said at the beginning. That is not in dispute. They lied because they lied. I would say if they had told the truth, they wouldn't have gotten a license to begin with. They lied. They got a license. They ultimately got caught. Now they're falling on their sword saying, we're really sorry. We've changed all the horses. But again, a lame win. I mean, this is beyond dispute. Joan makes this point brilliantly in her column. I think it was this morning.
It was.
Joan Vernocchi. She's the largest private shareholder. That hasn't changed. And she intentionally withheld critical information from the board. I think it was in 2013.
Yeah.
You can't challenge that.
And she also says that its board includes Dee Dee Myers, the White House press secretary for Bill Clinton, who described sexual harassment charges against Bill Clinton as complete lies. And she also says that Elaine, the ex-wife, and CEO Matthew Maddox have they're at each other's throats, that one of them is going to be pushing the other one out, and there could be a nasty battle that's probably underway now, but will even be more intensified after the casino opens. You could see that, Jim.
You know, and can we, there's another part. This Kin Marie Sinatra was the general counsel
for
the
company. I know. Is she related to Frank?
I don't think so. But I don't know, actually. I shouldn't say I don't think so. So she is the one that was suggesting that all this is BS when asked by board members.
Mm-hmm.
And lo and behold, she leaves the company again, according to Joan, in August with a $10 million severance payout. I mean, can it get any seedier than this?
You know, I remember going over when they were first coming into Boston when Wynn and his new wife, not Elaine, this is his, I don't know if she's his second wife or third wife, whatever she is, when they came over to Revere. And
I remember that too.
I mean,
You weren't there, were you?
I was there for the Herald.
Oh, okay.
And I don't mean to be judgmental, but you do take one look at the guy.
Well, that is judgmental. That's not fair.
And you take a look at the wife.
That's not fair.
It's just, you can just feel it almost. You know, it almost comes out of their pores. This is not a straight up sort of situation, these big time casinos. You know what I mean?
877-301-8970.
We're talking about Wynn Resorts asking you, should the Gaming Commission give Encore the go-ahead or pull the plug? The conversation continues on 89.7 WGBH, Boston Public Radio.
Welcome back to Boston Public Radio. I'm Jim Bradley. She's Marjorie. And if you're just tuning in, we're talking about Wynn Resorts. Now that the Mass Gaming Commission knows the extremes they went to in order to cover up allegations of sexual harassment and misconduct against Steve Wynn, who is now gone, by the way. We're asking you, what should the commission do about it? The term, just to get without giving you a headache, the term of art in the statute, the gaming statute, is you have to be found suitable. Well, they were found suitable years ago when they originally granted the license. The question is, are they still suitable? Their contention is, we've apologized. We know we screwed up. We've cleansed ourselves. Most of the evildoers, not their words, mine, on the board or staff or whatever, who knew about what Wynn was doing were good. We are supposed to believe that the chief financial officer and the right-hand guy, who's now the CEO, this guy Maddox, didn't know anything about the payoffs and that sort of stuff. And I guess we're supposed to believe that even though Elaine Wynn, the former wife of Steve Wynn, is the largest private shareholder, that her power in this thing, even though she lied to the Gaming Commission in 2013, I think, should not be of concern. The questions, I mean, let me repeat them. Joan Vernocchi phrased it perfectly. Can mass regulators trust Elaine Wynn when she did not tell them what she knew about Steve Wynn's alleged sexual misconduct when the company's suitability first came under consideration in 2013? Can they believe Maddox, that's the CEO, when he insists he knew nothing about sexual assault misconduct allegations against Wynn? And I think those are the answers to those things, at least to me, are fairly clear. 877-301-8970.
Let's go to Sarah in Cohasset. Hi, Sarah.
Hey, Sarah.
Hi, good morning.
Hi.
I just wanted to say, first of all, as a country, we have pretty much decided that we accept lying full-heartedly all the time.
I know. Doesn't it make you sad?
It makes me sick.
Yeah, me too.
It really does. But beyond that, this guy, Wynn, is like 125 years old. He walks away with his gazillions of dollars. And now the women who were sexually harassed are now like picking up the pieces of the sexual harasser. So the wife is now, everybody's at her throat, and he walks away. Dee Dee Myers supported Clinton. Monica and Hillary suffered. It's like, enough. I honestly don't care if she lied. I don't think she should be thrown under the bus.
Well, how is she?
You know what Wynn said, too, about this woman that says that he raped her and she became pregnant?
Mm-hmm.
That Wynn claims that she initiated the sexual advances.
Well, because they're concerned, because they didn't like Elaine Wynn. Their contention, they believe that it was all consensual, as Wynn had apparently said. Sarah, thank you. It's not a great connection. We've got to let you go. Thank you very much for your
She threw herself at the feet of Steve Wynn.
You know who really got this right, in my estimation? Well, two people got this right. One to the extreme, and I don't mean that in a pejorative way. The guy who railed against this in the biggest way was Scott Harshbarger, former attorney general, who said, we're going down a path that we are going to regret, I'm paraphrasing, regret forever. Now, the second person who had a compromise position, who I think got it right, considering the law was the law, was candidate Charlie Baker. Do you remember when Charlie,
yes,
when Governor Baker was
casino.
A candidate?
One casino.
Let's see how
he
it
was
works.
Absolutely right.
If it's clean, if they make a lot of money, if there's not oversaturation in the market, as some people suggest, then fine.
By the way, it's happening
in
everywhere.
In all New England.
The oversaturation. Your old hangout when you were a kid. What do you call that place where you worked?
Catskills.
The Catskills. They had that miserable picture of that casino up in the Catskills.
Nobody's
with,
gone.
With nobody at it. But you know what?
You know who didn't apply for original license? Guy who's from Dorchester. Who's a billionaire, Shelley Adelson, said, I'm not even going to apply because three casinos plus a slots parlor, which is what we could end up with, there are only two in a slots parlor license now, is too much.
But you know what's really sad? We would have none of these casinos if not for the recession of 2007.
Probably right.
I mean, I think that people were so upset about losing all their savings and in some cases losing their homes and the disaster that overtook the country then. I mean, that was the context in which we decided we were going to go this casino route. It was then. And I think it wouldn't happen now, but needless to say, it's too late. Pamela from Dartmouth. Hi, Pamela.
Hi, Pamela.
Hello. How are you?
Excellent.
I guess I tend to use my criterion of how I deal with this issue as a parent. If my daughter blatantly lied or misled me and then I apologized, would this make it okay? There would still be huge consequences. And what precedent do I want to set? The consequences wouldn't change, I guess, even if I'd made an investment. To me, this has nothing to do with casinos. It's drawing a line in the sand.
I agree with you. And some might argue, Marjorie possibly, Pamela, a huge fine is not nothing. But as Marjorie herself has said through the years in other settings, a huge fine is a corporate write-off. I mean, it doesn't matter how big the fine is. As long as they're allowed to keep doing business, the individuals aren't paying the price. The company as such is paying the price. So they'll change the odds at the slots tables or charge more for the drinks or whatever. So I'm with you, Pamela. I think I'm with you. Thanks for the call.
Well, also, if this casino were in Weston, I'd feel differently about this as well.
Because you're so concerned about Everett?
Well, there was a story in the paper today that half of the people in Massachusetts can't afford an apartment here, mm-hmm, because everything has become so expensive. And if you are working poor or you're really, really struggling, and Everett's not a wealthy town.
No, I understand that, but I have to say you're one of the most principled people I know, and I mean that sincerely with no sarcasm. It's a reward.
It's basically saying
because we're so concerned about Everett and surrounding areas, and because we're so concerned, which I am too,
yeah,
about thousands of jobs that could be delayed potentially for years, which is what Larry Edelman argues in his piece in the Boston Globe, then we really have no choice. Edelman's not saying nothing. He's saying fine them. Maybe get rid of Maddox.
A greater good argument. It's there now. It's built. It's
you know,
there.
This is going to be, by the way, the outcome. Every prediction I've ever made has been wrong. So take this with a grain of salt. I do think what the obvious outcome is going to be, because they're not going to have the courage to pull this license. What they're going to do is a big fine, and they're going to say Maddox has to step down. I mean, that is, don't you think that's the splitting of the baby here to show that we're not going to take this kind of crap, and I guess people will nod and say, well, you done a good thing kind of deal.
Yeah.
But they still profit from their misconduct.
And I don't know this because I don't understand enough about the way this works, but if some other casino owner could come in and take it over, and it would not be.
Yeah, but that's the place where Edelman is right, is if this is tied up in litigation.
That's exactly.
They deny the license, the continuation of the license,
right.
Immediately sued by Encore, whatever the name of the operation
so
is,
massive,
and no one's going to buy it in the
massive
middle.
Infrastructure falling apart over there on the waterfront in Everett for 5 years, and nobody gets any jobs, and Everett doesn't get any tax dollars. I mean, I just.
But there's a horrible moral to that story.
Well, but again,
you and I aren't disagreeing.
I know. There's a horrible moral, but and
there's
which
an
is
immoral
terrible.
To that story.
There's
is
an immoral
what
to
really...
that story. But again, so much of this gets colored with like this massive immorality we have hitting us in the face every day.
You know why this is, by the way, for whatever it's worth, I don't mean to get – well, actually, we're going to talk to Karen Spilka, the Senate president, about the tax reform and tax analysis. The reason we're even in this mess to begin with is because this state, like so many others, legislators are so scared to stand up and say – and governors in many cases – stand up and say, by the way, we need new tax dollars because X and Y need work. So what they do is they say opening a casino, expanding the lottery, doing keno on your dinner table, whatever it is, in sports betting, I'm assuming soon, is not a tax. It's a voluntary behavior. So we become so dependent on gambling that because we don't have the courage to tell the public the truth. And that's why we're even in this mess to begin with.
But as I always say, one of the big problems with convincing people that we need more taxes in Massachusetts is because Massachusetts leaders don't clean up some of the disgraces and the messes we have operating in Massachusetts already.
So why don't you say we shouldn't have a lottery until we know that they've cleaned up all the messes in terms of spending in cities and towns too?
Well, the lottery's been here for what, 20 years?
So what?
Well, I was making beautiful arguments against the lottery 20 years ago, Jimmy.
You were? I don't think you were, actually. I was. I don't think you were. Robert and Owen Everett, of all places. You're next on Boston Public Radio. Hi.
Hello, guys.
Hi.
I didn't think you were going to take my call because I was calling from Everett.
We're glad to have you.
I've been out of work for 4 years. It's been voluntary because I was a stay-at-home dad, but I'm ready to go back to work. And I was actually hired by this company. And I looked at... Yeah.
Wait, say it again. You've been hired by the new casino.
Yeah.
Okay, go ahead. I wanted to make sure I heard that right. Go ahead.
So I've really been looking forward for his job. I work in the culinary industry, and they're paying twice starting what I've made in my whole life of 28 years cooking. And I looked into the company, and as far as the way they treat their actual employees,
mm-hmm.
they have great benefits. They pay the highest. And this is all based, for me, I'm looking at this, this is all based on an accusation from a woman. We don't know what really happened. And she was paid millions of dollars, and I understand and totally side with people who've gone through any kind of sexual victimhood, because my mom did. But it always seems like the little guy is the one who pays the price, whether it's going to be the casino, the working class people like myself who has owned a home and has a mortgage, and always pays the price. Wall Street can screw everybody over. The CEOs walk away, and all the people who were really hurt pay the price.
You know, Robert, I have to say, even though I'm on the other side of this issue, you make a fabulous case with one exception. I would, if I may respectfully suggest, I'd take out of your argument, it's her word. I mean, not only was she paid $7.5 million this is reportedly not his only misconduct. Two, stepped down from his own company. And three, nobody in the Wynn infrastructure is denying that this is true. So I don't think that's even an issue. Beyond that, I think you make a wonderful point, is that the big boys, I mean, he left, he's doing perfectly well, even though his reputation's is in tatters. And you pay the price, which is, I guess, Marjorie's point. So I think you make the point well, and I do think you're going to carry the day. Robert, thank you for a great call. I mean, that is pretty hard to respond to. It's one thing for you to say it. It's another thing you to hear somebody who is dependent upon the income. And the likelihood is good, if you're sympathetic to Robert's future employment needs, and is that he is not going to be working there in June if the Gaming Commission does what I'd like them to do.
Sean on 128. Hi, Sean.
Hello, Sean.
Jim and Marjorie, I called you once before. I'm the guy that never knew I was a deplorable until a failed presidential candidate
Sean,
told me I
Sean.
But
how are you,
but
Sean?
Anyway, listen, I'm well, thank you. It's good to be back with you. Now, real quick, I know you're up against it.
Yeah.
I've actually accepted a position with a casino.
To do
I'm
what?
I'm in my mid-60s. I'm not going to say. I'm not going to be an executive, but I'm not going to say.
Okay.
I am going to be working on the gaming side of the business, okay? I'm one of these guys that's in between. I don't want to work a real job anymore, but I don't want to not work. And I found this to be probably a very nice fit for me. Now, that being said, we all know that Mr. Wynn is a maggot, to put it mildly, okay? And we know what he did, and we know what they paid and all that other stuff. But I think it does get down to what the previous caller said. There are a lot of people that are looking forward to have these jobs. I'll also echo what he said. I've learned that if you're going to work in the gaming industry, Wynn's is the place you want to work because they are good to their people. They've cleaned house. All the executive, the board has been changed, swapped out entirely, as from what I understand. And the only one left standing is Mr. Maddox.
Well, if I may, Elaine Wynn, the largest private shareholder, Sean, who essentially lied to the Gaming Commission on a pivotal piece of information, reports suggest that the current chair of the board, I think his name is Satra or something like that, was picked by her. So I don't think it's been totally cleansed. But go ahead, Sean.
That's another discussion. But just, you know, I was at the hearing on Monday. I went to the hearing. I hope to go. I was going to go this afternoon, but I'm not going to be able to. I've read their white paper, which the casino put out. I've read the report. Yes, all these things are true, but if they deny them the license and there's going to be dueling lawsuits for the next 3 years, and then, you know, a lot of people are going to be without jobs, and that's an area that needs jobs. But anyway, can I ask you just one more thing?
30 seconds, quick.
Real quick.
Okay. Lawrence O'Donnell is a friend of yours. He is a contemporary of General Kelly's. The next time you have him on the air, would you ask him for me if during their time at St. Sebastian's, how many times the general either stepped on his lunch, stuck him in his locker, or gave him a wedgie.
Sean, thanks. We love Larry O'Donnell.
We do love Larry O'Donnell.
Dorchester kid.
Yeah,
next time he's on, we'll do our
while,
best.
But I hope we will again because he's a great guest. He's got a show every night on MSNBC at 10 o'clock. Okay, up next, we're going to talk to the former sheriff of Suffolk County and Secretary of Public Safety, Andrew Cabral. Will be here with us for another edition of Law and Order. Andrew Cabral is next on 89.7 WGBH.
Ahead on Boston Public Radio, normally prisoners get busted for running drug deals from behind bars, but not so much for running drug companies. Martin Shkreli, remember him, a.k.a. Farmer Bro? He's been put in solitary confinement for using a contraband phone to steer his former pharmaceutical business from the Federal Correctional Institution in Fort Dix. Soon we'll talk to Andrew Cabral about this, a new program in Massachusetts to treat addiction in state prisons and more.
Then Senate President Karen Spilka joins us to talk about her ideas to review the state tax code and maybe find money to fund education and transportation. Then it's like mother, cartoonist Roz Chaz and humorist Patricia Marks are kindred spirits. It has a lot to do with their mothers being interchangeable. They've put this commonality to use in their hysterically funny new book, Why Don't You Write My Eulogy Now So I Can Correct It? A Mother's Suggestions. That more is next on Boston Public Radio. He's Jim Browdy. I am Marjorie Egan. You're listening to Boston Public Radio, 89.7 WGBH, hour number two. Jim.
Yeah.
Your hair's quite short today.
Oh, I told you.
Yeah. Give people an idea.
Oh, I didn't tell you. Oh, yeah. I'm glad you asked that again. I forgot. So yesterday was sort of this annual head shaving thing. The guy behind it is Rob Hale from Granite Telecommunications. The governor has been one of the leaders of this thing for years. He mentioned on the show the other day, and I've been able to participate in this the last couple of years. And what Hale does is he gives a certain amount of money for every single employee, and there were hundreds and hundreds who get their head shaved for cancer research. I think it's $5,000 or something. Gives $50,000 for a second tier of people, including people like me. I think $500,000 for the governor, something like that. So yesterday, there were not only a bunch of former Patriots, including Troy Brown, and some linemen from Super Bowls.
Wow, that's been a thrill.
Ray Bourque got his head shaved. Obviously, the great Bruin. And I think I'm forgetting somebody, a couple of state reps, Sam Kennedy, president of the Red Sox. But the best part of this is the surprise guest who was announced as the Sam Kennedy's hairstylist who was going to shave his head. And when they announced the hairstylist, who is it? David Ortiz. And the place goes absolutely berserk. So Ortiz shaved Kennedy's head. By the way, on Greater Boston tonight, we're going to have a package where you can see not only the workers themselves and a woman who shaved her head who's recovering from cancer, a little boy who had cancer when he was 4 who gets his head shaved every year. His name is Colin. He's now 10 or 11, I think, that sort of thing. And you'll get to see, I had some time to talk to Ortiz and the governor and some others. The bottom line here, which is really an incredible thing, Hale has contributed, Ray's contributed, counting yesterday, $6 million, somewhere in the neighborhood of $30 million that's gone to cancer research because of this stuff.
Wow, that's
yesterday,
fantastic.
$6.5 million went to Children's Hospital. So I love participating in it, even if I look a little odd after the fact.
Well, you don't. They didn't shave at all. I mean, well, my friend Alfred did it.
I bring my own hairstylist. I'm the only diva that does, actually. And it's just it's a fabulous event, and I thank them for letting me participate and all that sort of stuff. And it's great. And congratulations to the governor and Rob Hale for doing this thing. In any case, thanks for actually asking about that, Marjorie. What do we do? Oh, here we are. Here we're in Studio 3, but on the phone for another edition of Law & Order is Andrea Cabral. Andrea, as you know, is former sheriff of Suffolk County. She's also the former Secretary of Public Safety and the current CEO of Ascend. Hello there, Andrea.
Hi, how are you?
Excellent, thank
you. We are great. So we've got some good prison stories to discuss with you,
good
Andrea Cabral.
Stories.
You were the former sheriff over there in Suffolk County. Better late than never, prisons in Massachusetts are now giving medication to prisoners who suffer from an opioid addiction. Tell us what they're doing and I guess why they didn't do this before.
Well, I think the medications that are being used are Suboxone, Methadone, and Naltrexone, which is probably the newest. People might know it by its commercial name is Vivitrol, and it's a non-narcotic. It's the only one of the medications that's a non-narcotic, and it suppresses or eliminates the physical craving for the drug. We started using it when I was secretary at the DOC. It was a monthly injection, and we would give people the injection just before they left and then hook them in with clinics where they could continue to receive a monthly injection. I think it's now available in a pill form. The Suboxone and methadone has been used for a very, very long time, and it's been particularly used particularly with pregnant women who are in prison. And Suboxone is the third one. Suboxone, the concern among prison officials is that it is one of the most smuggled drugs into prison facilities. So I think the resistance to using Suboxone on the part of prison officials was largely due to the fact that it was a much coveted drug inside institutions. Methadone is highly regulated, and so there's a little bit more to it in administering methadone inside of a facility. But the good news is that courts have ruled that this is acceptable treatment, and that inmates ought to have access to it. So now you've got several county sheriff's offices are actually doing it under a different law, and then you have the state DOC doing it as well.
The backdrop for this, but I didn't know the numbers were this intense in this piece by Felice Fryer in the Boston Globe. The issue of treatment for addicted inmates, she writes, has gained attention as states grapple with the opioid crisis. Two-thirds of inmates suffer from some kind of addiction, and they face an extremely high risk of fatal overdose upon release. So is the resistance to this, Andrea Cabral, historically been ideological? Or is it more, we need a lot of person power to monitor this? For example, to make sure they mentioned certain lozenge form of one of these treatments has to be kept under your tongue, I think, for 7 to 10 minutes. Obviously, the fear is that the inmate is going to not leave it there and take it in and sell it inside the prison. So is it person power shortages or is it ideological that's been the block?
It's probably been, you know, in honesty, it's probably been a bit of both. Historically, the sort of cold turkey approach, once a person was incarcerated, was long held to be the most effective type of withdrawal and detoxification. And, you know, I don't think that the science necessarily bears that out, especially with the rates of relapse. But everything in a correctional setting comes down to the available people power and whether or not you can administer this in an orderly fashion, in a way that doesn't sort of get away from you, where you don't have issues of contraband and smuggling. And, you know, that's a consideration. I think with these rulings, I think it then becomes incumbent upon the state as a whole to make sure that all institutions are adequately staffed in order to make sure that this is successful. Mm-hmm.
Well, you know, something that takes, we've talked to you, I think, for years about how important the reentry issue is so that there's not absurd levels of recidivism, which really sort of undercuts the whole point of this thing. And an area that seems to me requires a lot less person power, even though there is some cost, which is also proven to help people once they get out, is the free phone call from prison. And I knew that New York City had allowed it starting, I think, a year ago, but Connecticut may soon become the first state to allow free calls from prison to their families. There is no dispute, I assume, here that there are better outcomes when people stay in touch with the people they're closest to. Closest to in a wonderful way. I don't mean in a gang kind of way, family, loved ones, that sort of thing. That leads to better results. That's beyond dispute, is it not?
It absolutely is. And it's really, I mean, it's a sad thing to say, but what this comes down to is private contracts with private vendors that are negotiated by you know, state and county run institutions that are expensive. And the money is essentially a tax on people who are doing time in order to stay in touch with loved ones. And what happened to the institutions over time, where the state was cutting budgets and cutting budgets and cutting budgets, they became dependent on the income. So the institution gets a portion of, historically has gotten a portion of the what is charged to an inmate. And it's the same, it happens whether it's telephone calls or anything else. Once a government agency becomes dependent on income from an outside source, not only does the legislature tend to respond to that outside income by leveling the budget or continuing to cut the particular budget, it becomes the responsibility of the institution to maintain that level of income from an outside source. And because clearly these phone calls do not cost this much. If you can go to T-Mobile and get a 4-line family plan for $40 a month per person, I think it's possible to make phone calls from an institution that are not onerous and costly. And the cost falls on the family, largely, of the person who is incarcerated versus the person who is incarcerated. So for people who think, well, you know, if you've done something wrong and been convicted, then you should have to pay for your phone calls. Why should the state pay for it? It's essentially a tax on people's families.
You know, what this reminds me of, the unholy alliance and dependence upon this money that you talk about. This is like when we talk about crappy food in vending machines in schools, and the vendors pay a lot of money to schools that are underfunded, as we're going to discuss with Paul Revel this afternoon. And then the schools become reliant upon what, I don't know, like a soda manufacturer or some crappy food producer pays to them. So it's like this vicious cycle kind of thing. But it seems to me, I know nothing about running prisons. I'm sure you'll be the first to acknowledge that. And you know virtually everything about it. But if there's one thing on the cheap that it seems could be done that is not person intensive or staff intensive, it's free phone calls to appropriate people. So you don't know if there's any effort in Massachusetts to emulate what may happen in Connecticut, do you?
I don't know of anything specific to the Connecticut plan, but there certainly has been a great deal of controversy around the cost of calls and ways to sort of mitigate that or even introduce more competition among vendors so that you're able to choose someone who's offering a much lower price. But, you know, to me, there's sort of a 30,000-foot view of all of this that ties into private prisons, that ties into having private corporations run prisons. It is essentially an abdication of government responsibility to pay for these things. It's government that has the process by which people end up incarcerated. And over the years, bit by bit, sometimes in very large leaps, government has stepped away from that responsibility, which is really important in terms of the kinds of standards we keep for how we run institutions, how we measure success in our state agencies. The further away you step from that and the more that devolves to the responsibility of a private for-profit corporation, the less government means in people's lives and the less accountable government is to the governed. And that's a huge problem. So this is an element of it, but it is by no means the whole thing.
We're talking to Andrea Cabral, the former sheriff of Suffolk County. Andrea, there was a really upsetting story in the New York Times, the headline of which was Alabama's Gruesome Prisons Report Finds Rape and Murder at All Hours, comes complete with pictures of knives that inmates have made from fan blades, of prison clothing covered in blood. It goes through a week in the Alabama prisons in September of 2017. You know, three stabbings, one beating, drug cadre, stabbing, sexual assault, beating with a sock full of metal locks, one case of arson where a prisoner's bed was set on fire, on and on and on. You know, it's not clear whether all these prisons in Alabama are run privately or by the state, but it's so bad that the Justice Department has threatened to sue them, because they have the highest rates of homicide and rape in the country, and, quote, a level of violence that is too common, cruel, of an unusual nature, and pervasive. It's a just nauseating story. So what's your take on this?
Fucking story. I'm surprised that there's not a class action lawsuit independent from what the Justice Department does that alleges or complains that the mere fact of having to be incarcerated in facilities like this constitutes cruel and unusual punishment, because it's certainly not what is envisioned by regular incarceration. And I get the impression from reading the story, this has been going on for a very long time, that governors are well aware of it, past governors and the present governor are well aware of it. They tend to respond by asking for money to build new prisons. And it's not that they don't need new facilities. Apparently, in addition to everything else, the facilities themselves are very old and crumbling and falling down. But this is more about order and how you maintain order. And so the Justice Department intervened during the end of the Obama administration. Their intervention in their attempt to do the investigation and the consent decree has continued into the Trump administration. But Jeff Sessions, when he was attorney general, made some changes
from Alabama
to the rules. And he's from Alabama. And of course, it made the process less onerous on Alabama. And he sort of used this ridiculous states' rights argument. I don't know what state has the right to treat people like this, but so he sort of tried to pull it back a little bit. The good news is that the it's still proceeding. The complaint by the Justice Department is still proceeding. But I look at something like this and I think to myself, I think Alabama might be a right to work state. I don't know if their corrections officers are unionized. They're very low paid. This is a basement ground up solution that's needed here. This is not going to be solved by building new facilities. It's not going to be solved by an infusion of money. While those things might help, there is a really incredibly systemic problem here with the way these facilities are being run, and it has everything to do with who's leading these facilities and who's in charge. And you really do have to start there.
You know,
because,
also,
you know, this is.
God,
well,
I'm sorry.
You know, they talked about the reporter went in one of these facilities and said that the place was virtually ungoverned and the inmates were walking around armed.
Yeah.
And they don't have nearly enough prison guards, and they need $31 million to hire 500 more prison guards and raise pay, the issues that you just raised. I mean, it's just – it sounds like medieval.
It really does. I have to say, one of the most shocking stories. I'm not naive about what goes on in prison, but this is truly a shocking thing, and – there's literally no order there. And this, the state is responsible for this. I mean, this isn't, you know, sort of on happening on some, barely inhabited island somewhere that has no form of government. The state is responsible for this. And ultimately, the violence that happens, they need to answer for all of that, including the rapes and the homicides. They need to answer for that.
You know, the thing I was going to say before, I hope this doesn't sound as callous as it's probably going to come out. You know, there are a lot of people I assume would say, well, the best way to avoid being treated like this is don't commit horrible crimes. You won't go to jail. So I will accept that, even though I don't agree with it for a minute, because they are human beings. But even if you don't care about those people, if you care about these people, namely us, the vast majority of people get out of jail. And if people wonder why men and women get out of jail and are violent, it seems to me, what do you expect out of somebody who's treated like this and has to submit to this kind of environment when they're incarcerated by the state? I mean, it is so destructive, both to them as individuals and inhumane and probably unconstitutional, as you said, Andrew Cabral. It is also inhumane to those of us who end up living with these people when they have paid their debt to society. So these kinds of stories just really put me over the edge. In any case, talking to Andrew Cabral. Now, there is one good news story we didn't get to in terms of prison, because if there's one thing I appreciate is an entrepreneurial spirit.
Exactly.
And it turns out that, as I said at the top of the show, it's one thing if you're doing a drug deal in prison, but it's another thing if you're running a drug company in prison. And it appears that I think he is the former most hated man in America, Pharma Bro, as we call him, Martin Shkreli, who's in a minimum security prison, has been running a drug company from federal prison using a contraband smartphone. This is the guy, by the way. He unfortunately is in jail for securities fraud. He is not in jail for what he should be in jail for. Do you remember when he had that drug? What was it called? Daraprim or whatever it was called?
Where he raised
the price
5,000% or something?
5,000% or something like that. From $13.50 a pill to $7.50 a pill. And wasn't his excuse was that he did it because he could? Wasn't it something like that?
Yeah, he was totally unapologetic. He just kind of said, hey, this is what the market will bear. What the hell? And then he was sort of smirking at everybody, you know, during his court appearances and so forth.
So my only response to this is they should transfer him to a prison in Alabama. What do you think, Andrea?
Well, I don't know. Even for this guy who is truly loathsome, I mean, I have to agree with you. He is just sort of a sociopath when it comes to any sort of sense of what he's done wrong. And I think one of the stories indicates that he sort of walks around with a couple of bodyguards that are supposed to be keeping him from any sort of harm inside the prison. But I think what will happen as a result of this, so he got 7 years for securities fraud.
Mm-hmm.
He certainly won't be getting paroled anytime soon, so he can forget about that. He just bought himself probably a couple of parole days where he's not really going to be eligible. But to the extent that additional criminal charges can be lodged against him for anything that he's done, and I'm not sure exactly. They sort of said running his drug company from prison. I'm not sure if anything criminal is implied. I'm sure the state will bring criminal charges against him, or the county will bring criminal charges against him, and he may face additional charges. But it is astonishing that somebody like this would go to could go to prison and decide that, you know, to sort of flout the rules, even inside prison. He's incredibly arrogant.
You think so? I hadn't noticed that.
Just a little bit.
I think he's got a bit of an arrogance, and he's the guy who bought the Wu-Tang Clan album, the very rare collectible for like $1 million. He ended up having to forfeit it, but he was bragging to people that he had bought this, only one of its kind Wu-Tang album, and that he had spent $1 million on it while he was charging people thousands of dollars for this particular drug. So he's completely unapologetic, but the system has a way of dealing with people who are as unapologetic and sociopathic as this guy appears to be.
You know, I don't want to belabor this, but because we've discussed it ad nauseum through the years, what kind of person increases the cost of it? I just looked up 56 times. It was $13.50. He raised it to, I think, $750. What kind of person does this? I mean, what kind of person does this?
Maybe he had a bad mother.
He'd have to be pretty soulless. Yeah. And that's
or
why
sociopath.
I don't know that he has empathy. Yeah. I don't think he has empathy. He clearly doesn't.
Yeah, it's bizarre. Andrea, thank you very much.
Andrea, thanks. Take care of yourself.
Yeah. Andrea Cabral joins us every week for Law & Order. She's the former Suffolk County Sheriff and Secretary of Public Safety and current CEO of Ascend.
By the way, I had forgotten this. I'm sorry to go ahead.
What?
This drug was to treat patients with AIDS-related and AIDS-unrelated,
AIDS
whatever.
Right. Sick people.
He's a very sick people.
He's a very sick person.
Thank you.
Several people have emailed in about your hair, Jim. I want you to know you shaved it off yesterday.
I did shave it off.
Daniel wants to know, Jim's head? Where does Jim have hair?
That's a really good one. That's
and Stephen said it was very exciting for him to watch the news last night and see little pieces of Jim's head poking out from behind the governor.
Well, I position myself right behind Ray Bourque, Sam Kennedy, president of the Red Sox, and Charlie Baker. I worked very hard to get that spot.
Good for you.
In the peanut gallery there.
Because you were spotted on the news by our listeners.
They raised $6 million yesterday. It's unbelievable.
They did.
$6 million.
You're a better man than I am.
No, I'm not a better man.
I would not shave off
my hair. Well, I'm a better
man
by definition. But
okay, human being. I would not shave my hair off. There's no
way. Actually, next year you're going to do this.
No, I am not. No, I'm not. Okay, up next. Senate President Karen Spilka is urging fellow lawmakers to pass her Gender X bill, which would benefit non-binary residents. She joins us for that and more. This is 89.7 WGBH, Boston Public Radio.
Welcome back to Boston Public Radio. Jim Browdy and Marjorie Egan. At the State House, lawmakers are looking for money to fund education and transportation. Senate President Karen Spilka has an idea that would have a far greater impact than doing what the rest of us do when we need money, which is go on to findmassmoney.com. Her plan is to assemble a working group to study the state's tax code. I love that. She joins us here in Studio 3 to talk about this, her push to pass the Gender X bill, and other developments on Beacon Hill. Senate President Spilka, it's good to see you. Thanks for being here. Hello.
Thank you. Thanks so much.
Okay. Oh, we had a mic.
I was adjusting
there.
The microphone over there.
Very skillfully, I should say.
Great to be here.
Nice to see you.
Nice to see you too, Senate President. So, if you ever met Joe Biden, by the way.
Have I? No.
Yeah. Well, I wonder what you think. You've been in politics for a while. You know, now seven women have said that he inappropriately touched them. He did kind of a mea culpa saying he's going to be better in the future. None other than Stacey Abrams said, you know, not everybody should be, I'm paraphrasing, but in essence, not everybody should be known by the worst thing they ever did kind of thing. What do you think? Do you think that this is curtains and drapes for his effort to be the president, or can he recover from this?
I think it's up to the people to decide, just like for everything else. He's got a long history. I think that, you know, he might be a little touchy, but I think that the people should have a chance to listen to what he has to say and decide for themselves whether or not they want to support him.
Do you have a candidate yet, by the way?
I am supporting Elizabeth Warren.
Oh, you are?
Yes.
Oh.
Were you in Lawrence?
What was that like? What was that?
It was very powerful. I didn't know what to expect either. There were a lot of people there. The setting was tremendous in the old mill where the strike was, and it was very exciting. A lot of great energy. So it was a beautiful day. It was incredibly windy, but it acted with the buildings around you. It just really protected you. So it was a very energizing day, and I think she did a great job.
You know, one last thing about her is, in my view, this is not a pro or anti endorsement kind of thing, but you know, every Margie and I've been doing this for almost 20 years. Every presidential election cycle, every gubernatorial cycle, what people say is, "You people spend too much time on the horse race and polls and how they look, and not enough on substance." I think it's even if you're not supporting Elizabeth Warren, there is no candidate who is coming even close. Maybe Bernie Sanders in terms of concrete proposals, whether you like him or not, and she's languishing in the polls. How do you explain that?
It's unfortunate, but people are used to sound bites. She is a policy wonk. I love it because I'm a policy wonk. So I really listen to what she has to say, and I think it's great. People look at demeanors. They hear the sound bites. They get bored, I think, after a short period of time. So I think that if anything, she needs to figure out a better way to capture the essence of what her proposals are, because they are really good proposals on so many different issues.
You know what I think she's got to do? If you can give her, I don't want to give her advice because I do what I do. Next time she talks, I don't know, about tax policy or corporate criminals, she should jump up on the hood of a truck, I think is... Don't you think that would make it a lot more appealing?
Well, she's pretty active, actually. There was a great picture of her running down a hill.
Well, that got more attention than anything.
Yeah, and I also think that having seen her myself in action, she's much better a retail politician than I think the public thinks, but most people are not going to see her in those kind of settings. But she's good. She gets big crowds, and there's a lot of excitement, and I love her idea for universal child care.
She's smart. She is personable. I think she's a great candidate.
Well, obviously, if she's smart and is good on the issue, she has no chance. Let's just move on if we can. Senate President, I am really excited, I should say, about this tax code examination you're doing. Could you tell us exactly what it is you are doing, and then we can talk about it a bit?
Yes. What I want to do is just have a deep dive examination into our tax code, both business and personal. It hasn't been done in decades. We are based on an old economic society, our tax codes. We're not capturing new revenue. We are behind the curve with all of the new industries. It took us years to catch up on the transportation networks, years for the home sharing. There's now sports betting. There's a whole bunch of other things coming down the pike, and it takes us years. It's not just us. It's all of the legislators to better understand. And that's what triggered it in my mind, that by the lag, it creates a lot of confusion for not only the businesses involved, but the governments involved and the consumers, clearly. So if there's some way to capture that in a more fair, simpler, not regressive way, that we can capture the money and support the programs and services, just take a holistic look at what our tax code, make it more modern. I think that's long overdue.
You know, why don't you talk about one of your ideas, which actually I thought was a good idea.
What was that?
Well, we don't have progressive taxes in Massachusetts.
You mean the income tax?
Yeah.
Well, the Senate President knows better than I. We have a flat tax. One of my favorite people, that would be me, attempted in 1994 to amend the state constitution. It was the fifth effort. We lost by a narrow 71-29% margin to change to a graduated income tax. You know, the other thing,
really help the people that are struggling.
Right.
I mean,
it
is kind of, you know, the problem with the flat tax to me is that you're essentially getting the same percentage taken out when you're got nothing to take as you are when you're one of these.
A larger portion in the long run. Well, the millionaire's tax is an attempt to do it with recognition, I think, of the prior efforts, just like you were talking about, that have not been successful. But I think there's a lot of other ways to create a more progressive tax that will decrease income inequality, increase the earned income tax credit. We've done that
twice. Charlie Baker has been pretty good on,
the
governor.
The Senate, we took the lead. We've done it. Mm-hmm. The governor has been very supportive. But there are a lot of other things that we can do, and I think we need to look at that.
You know, from what I've read, Senate President spoke in the last couple of days, is Baker said he's pretty much, well, he says I'm still opposed to broad-based tax increases. He says something like, I'll give the Senate the benefit of the doubt. Let's see what they have to do. It's an important exercise. Your House colleague, Bob DeLeo, seems to be a lot less receptive. Does that not sort of stop this thing in its tracks? Or
no. You know, the House is a separate body. They can do or not do whatever they want. This, I feel... I've talked to Senator Adam Hines, who's the chair of revenue, and we agree, and many of my colleagues in the Senate agree, that this is a good path. This is a 1 to 2 year look. It's not a short term. There's a lot of things that we need to look at and review. This is the beginning of my Senate presidency. It's a new era, I believe, in the Senate. We really are strong on collaboration, working together. As much as the House wants to work with us, I think is great. But I'm hoping that out of this will be generated some ideas that we can share and talk and, you know, see where it goes.
Let me just ask here. This is self-serving, I would admit, before Marjorie says it is self-serving. So I'll beat her to the punch. In the early 90s, the group I ran sponsored and successfully lobbied for a tax on services in this state. We're a state that if you buy a lawnmower, you pay a tax. If you hire someone to mow your lawn, you don't pay a tax. The legislature, which had been complaining for years that the late Barbara Anderson could stop them from doing taxes, we get this service tax in place. And, of course, they repeal it in a minute and a half because they were scared to death of her. Wouldn't that pass Charlie Baker's criterion for what is a new tax and what isn't a new tax if you were to do that? Because it's not a new sales tax. It's an expansion of the existing sales tax. I don't want to give people a headache at home, to just a broader spectrum of things to reflect the new economy. Is that not reasonable?
I don't know how governor would respond to that, but these are things. I think that everything should be on the table for this working group. We have businesses involved. We have progressive labor organizations involved.
This.
We have experts, and we have economists and tax experts, and just a really broad, diverse group of people looking at this. So I'm excited about the whole prospects of it.
If real people, otherwise known as non-elected officials, want to weigh in on this, what's the vehicle for doing that?
They can contact Senator Adam Hines' office and submit, you know, information.
Will there be hearings at some point publicly?
I'm hoping. I mean, this is just getting going, and I think he's been really good at forming a solid working group.
Great. We're talking to Karen Spilka, Senate President.
You know, this one really gets me going because I think it shows a real misunderstanding of what it is like to be pregnant and have a baby. This fight over this so-called, what's it called, the Roe Act, which would allow women who are carrying babies they want but that are going to die at birth because they have severe anomalies. And this is obviously very rare, but it's not so rare that we didn't have a story by Yvonne Abraham in the Globe today talking exactly about this, about a woman who had to go to Colorado and spend $15,000 because she was in this situation where she had a tragedy and this baby was not going to survive. But she was expected in the state of Massachusetts, and I think Governor Baker's on the wrong side of this, to carry that baby to term. So you have something growing inside you 24 hours a day that's going to die. It's just incredible. Explain what this bill is and what you think about it.
Well, the Roe Act updates and a lot of the rules for women's reproductive health care and addresses some issues concerning abortion. It changes some of the laws, such as what you're referring to. Currently, a woman cannot have an abortion in Massachusetts after 24 weeks unless the woman's life is in danger. It does not take into account the physical health of the fetus. And that's exactly what you're saying. Now, with so much progress with medical care and health care, it is easier for the doctors, the healthcare clinicians, to be able to tell if there is a fetus that is not growing, that the brain is not at all growing, and that it will die either upon delivery or very soon thereafter. Will not be able to have any life, any viability. So this would suggest that we could take into account the doctors and the decision would be between the woman and the doctor, which is where I believe it should be, whether or not what to do with that pregnancy if in fact the fetus is not at all viable. And so that's part of it, and it would also change the law. Right now, you need a doctor's or either parental consent or court consent if you're a minor. That would this Roe Act would take that away as well.
Yeah, and the thing that they point out in this piece is that it's been totally misrepresented by opponents talking about women killing doctors killing babies on the delivery table, which is absolutely ridiculous. It's infanticide. You've heard this on the national front. You've heard it here locally, which is not at all what this is about.
Right.
It's about something completely different.
I agree.
We're talking to Karen Spilka. Could you explain to us what your gender X license proposal does, Senator President?
Yes.
You testified on this, by the way.
Yes, I did.
You know, I used to lobby at the State House. I use the term lobby loosely. I don't know if I ever saw a Senate president. Bulger was president for much of the time I was there. Senate presidents don't testify that much, do they, or do they?
They don't.
So what was this? Why'd you do this?
This bill is really special to me.
Why?
This came about one day I went to my P.O. box about a year ago, a little more than a year ago, brought home a lot of the mail that I get. Opened them up, and there was a letter from a young constituent reading, and it basically said, I am about to take my permit test for a license. I'm looking into getting my license. It's causing me a lot of anxiety, frustration, and stress. And I thought, wow, I remember when my kids got their licenses. That was like a milestone. It's a day they celebrated. Of course, as a parent, you don't. But it was exciting. It was a positive experience. And they went on to say, I am going to be required to check either male or female when I identify with neither. And then they had at the end of the letter just something that hit me. It was an incredibly powerful, beautifully written letter. And they said, this is about validating people and letting people be who they are. Mm. It was just simple, letting people be who they are. I need you to step up to the plate and help us, basically. I immediately called them and left a message. A few minutes later, they called me back and we talked. And I said to them, would you be willing to work with us to draft a bill? And would you help us through the process? And they said yes. And they started crying. I started crying. I mean, it was just really wonderful, an amazing young person. So we started working together, got to know their family. They came to my swearing in. We've developed this relationship, but it really helped me look at this whole issue in a different way. And it is simply about letting people be who they are. And I believe it's a civil rights issue.
What's the prospect of this thing?
I think at this point, I think the prospect is good.
Governor weighed in yet or no?
I think he's fine with it. We've talked about it. The RMV is ready to roll with this. They just recently redid their whole software. They have the possibility of three boxes. They already have two, the male or female, so they could easily add another X without a single penny cost. So I think that once the Senate does it, hopefully the House will do it. I believe that the governor will support it.
Any other state done this yet? I'm sorry, Margaret.
There are other states that have done this, and some states are now looking into amending birth certificates, which we put in the Senate version as well. So we'll see where that goes. But we need to do this as a state because I think this is really a statement that we accept people for who they are.
And this teenager that you spoke with was not sure of where they were going.
You know, upon asked, which would you check? They said, I don't think I would check either.
Okay. The only thing I thought of is that I wondered, you know, if you were this teenager and you got your gender is X on your license and you get pulled over by a police officer that finds this not, you know, they just are not on board with this kind of thing. I worry about that a little bit. That you know what I mean? You could be in a dark road at 11 o'clock at night, you know?
Yeah, although something like that could happen, but then that person should get some training. Police officer needs
I'm worried about
training.
Abuse, actually.
I know, but
who, when you present your license and it's not male or female, it's X, that you're going to get a lot of abuse.
Well, a lot of people look now. When you look at them, it's hard to tell their gender, male or female. And what difference does it make in the long run? And I think that the more we talk about this, the more we raise this, the more we act on it, the less things like that will happen.
Yeah.
Okay, we're talking to Karen Spilka. We were talking before about your, what's your tax thing called? What's that commission called? Does that have a name?
The Revenue Working Group.
The Revenue Working Group. Well, that's a creative name for something.
Yes, I know.
That sort of
I thought it was appropriate.
See if we can come up with something better here. You know, my thesis is this, which you may reject. One of the reasons we have so much gambling in the state, you know, with lottery, which is as regressive as anything ever was. I mean, it's basically Robin Hood in reverse, but cities and towns are greatly dependent on it. We have keno machines on restaurant tables, like Marjorie's favorite restaurant. What's the name of the restaurant again?
You ridicule this restaurant all the time.
I do.
It's my hometown. It's in Somerset.
What's it called?
Magoni's.
Magoni's,
where my
right.
family goes for all their
really
events.
A nice
and
thing.
All he does
go to dinner, have
it.
Keno table.
Well, you know,
we're
what
probably gonna, we may have sports gambling.
Conversation's game, boring.
We'll
you can play a little Keno.
We'll ask you about that in a minute. And obviously, we have this whole casino thing playing out in Everett. And my thesis is because there's such tax phobia on Beacon Hill through the years. You're nodding in agreement. I hope it means you agree. But whether you do or not, that's why we rely on gambling. So, Wynn, the hero, I think we're day three in the hearing. I know this is not your decision. I know the decision rests with the 5-member gaming commission, and the attorney general told us last week, Maura Healey, that she is watching it closely. She'll review it. She may get involved if she thinks the decision is inappropriate based upon the testimony. Where are you in this thing? I mean, it seems to me, we had a caller who's really powerful, a young, was it Rob was his name, from Everett?
I think so.
Who has already gotten a job there, and he was responding to me saying, I understand the jobs, I understand the needs of Everett, but, you know, the law is the law and morality is morality. And he says, I'm dependent on this, great health care, best wage I've had. Don't take this, essentially, don't take this away from me. My reading of this, Senate President, is that the leadership of the Wynn operation intentionally lied to the Gaming Commission in 2013, I think. Without the lying, including from his ex-wife, they probably wouldn't have gotten the license to begin with. They're caught years later. They come in and apologize and say, don't worry, we've cleansed ourselves, even though I think there's a lot of cleansing that hasn't been done. And it seems to me that if we grant, we say they're still suitable and allow them to proceed, that we're basically making a suggestion that this is yet another too big to fail operation, despite the fact that they knowingly deceived the regulators in the state on an industry that's suspicious enough to begin with. So I'm done my monologue. I should have shut up already. What's your take on this whole Wynn thing, and what concerns do you have, if any?
I think that we set up a gaming commission, gave it a lot of authority to investigate things just like this, and they're doing their job. They are doing their job. They did it when they were first looking at suitability. If people held back, then that's one story, you know, one side.
Well, there's no dispute, by the way. They don't even deny that.
They couldn't have found out at the time when they were doing the original suitability license. They did do an incredible investigation, and probably out of all of the states that have gaming now, we gave them the most authority and direction, and they have very high standards. So I think they need to live up to those standards in this situation as well. I think the integrity of this process is really important for our not only the history of the short history we have of gaming so far, but for our future of gaming. So I think that there's options along the way. It'll be up to them to figure out the best course of action if there is intentional lying or negligence or whatever along the way, and they will be, I assume, issuing a report with a lot of fact finding and conclusion and the decision of what to do. You know, if in fact what you were saying is found out, another option could be is that they conditionally let it open on the condition that it's sold to, you know, quickly, so that all of the 5,000 folks who have been hired and are ready to go to work in June can do that, and we're not pulling the rug out from so many thousands of people with their livelihood and supporting their families, but we're also sending the message that this is not going to be tolerated. So I think that, and there probably are other options along the way.
Is that an option that you think, based on what you've read and heard so far, makes the most sense?
I honestly don't know. I don't know. I have not been sitting through the hearings, and so I'm reluctant to answer.
Okay, one last thing before you go, real quick.
Oh, we're up in arms about this, too. We're obsessed with everything. You can talk about the airport. Is that what you're talking about?
I could talk about the airport.
Oh,
I'm up in arms.
I'm
up in arms about the airport. You know, I don't want to be dropped off by Uber and Lyft 7 minutes from the terminal and have to lug all my luggage. Suppose it's like 15 degrees and I can still walk pretty well. You know,
what if you have a little kid?
Exactly. I mean, I know that there's a problem with crowding at the airport. I know East Boston is in a mess over there and all these kinds of things. But I mean, this is a new idea, is that to make the cars move faster, that we have to have Uber and Lyft go off to a separate place, 5 to 7 minute walk from the terminal.
It's Massport's proposal, we should make
clear. By the way, I want to know who's been timed on this 5 to 7 minute walk. You know, it depends, doesn't it, really? Some people can walk really fast. It could be 20 minutes, Jim. You know what I'm saying? In the winter, February, 10 degrees.
What do you think about this?
Yeah, I think that... Again, once again, my response is it's great that there are discussions about this, because what came out recently, Massachusetts is number one in the country in congestion. That's not something we should actually be proud of, being number one at this point. And we need to talk about this. We need a comprehensive look at our transportation, our congestion. What more can we be doing to get people off the road, get them more into public transit, and to really ride share and do whatever we can? So I don't know if this is going to ultimately be the solution for mass or what they end up implementing. But any discussion, I commute in from the western part, take
terrible.
The pike. Oh, recently it was middle of the day I came in. It took me 35 minutes. Normally, if it's even touching rush hour, it's at least an hour and a half to 2 hours.
Congestion pricing. That's another thing we don't have time
for. The Senate had that in our budget.
I think that's a
great
idea.
Do you drive yourself or do you have a driver?
Oh, yeah, I drive myself.
You do?
Like to drive.
Oh,
you know what's the problem? The Logan Express bus. No one buys it. It's going to be express. Nobody buys if you get there at Back Bay of the airport. They're not going to...
Out in Framingham, it's really busy, and I think they're even thinking about expanding the location because a lot of people... So I think in letting people know the services and having people try it, anything that gets people off the roads, out of their own cars, I think is helpful.
You know, before you go, actually, we said before you go twice, so this will be the final one, I think the third. We have Paul Revel, the former Secretary of Education, with us in about a half hour.
We will.
And when he was a mere boy, he was intimately involved in the original Education Reform Act in 1994 that attempted to equalize the state payments to cities and towns, poor towns, rich towns. There was testimony the other day, man from Brockton, I don't know if it was a man or woman, in front of the one of the committees, saying we spend $1 on supplies, Weston spends $200 per kid. Weston spends $275. I read the story in the Boston Globe, and I worried that we're going to go through another year where there's going to be no resolution to this grotesque education funding imbalance. Are you honestly optimistic?
Yes.
Are you just saying that because you have to say
No, this is what I ran for the legislature for in the early 2000s. I had formed a Chapter 70 roundtable coalition of all the people to...
Another well-named organization.
I know.
Catchy.
Pretty clear. You know, what it is what it is. I fought to change the Chapter 70 funding formula. That's what I came to the legislature for. We made some changes back in 2006 on equity, predictability, and made it a little bit fairer and simpler, but the adequacy continued to elude us. So this is a piece that is personally important to me, very important to the Senate. We have passed the Foundation Budget Review Commission's recommendations 3 times the last 2 sessions. One session, we did it twice. Even though the bill hasn't passed, we have implemented a lot of the pieces of it in the budget, putting tens of millions of dollars more in, you know, not only the health care piece, but English language learners and low-income students. And we recognize the need to do it. We need a systematic way to implement it. I believe that will happen this year. I know that Chair Lewis and Chair Peisch from the House are working hard on this they're doing a tour around the state. They're meeting with people. I am very hopeful it will be done. And whatever is done in the budget, we will continue to try to implement it in the interim.
It was nice to see you, Senator.
Thank you very much for coming in, Senate President. Senate President Karen Spilka is a Democrat representing the 2nd Middlesex and Norfolk District. Thank you very much
for
taking the time. Coming up, Mother Knows Best. At least she thinks she does. We're going to talk to the New Yorker duo humorist Patricia Marks and cartoonist Roz Chast about their latest collaboration, which is a riot, which taps into the burden and blessing of mom. They're next on 89.7 WGBH, Boston Public Radio.
Welcome back to Boston Public Radio. Jim Browdy and Mardrigan. Necessity may be the mother of invention, but in the case of Patricia Marks and Roz Chast, it's mother who's the necessity of invention, at least mom would like to think so. The two have collaborated on a wildly funny new book. Why don't you write my eulogy now? I'm going to laugh when I say the title. Why don't you write my eulogy now so I can correct it? A Mother's Suggestions. It's a collection of real life and real world advice dispensed in one-liners by Patricia Marks' own mom. It's illustrated by Roz Chast. And yes, mom is still alive. Because when you read this book, you realize she's not going anywhere until she does see the first rough draft of her eulogy. Roz Chast, as you know, is a cartoonist most closely associated with The New Yorker, the author of several books. Patricia Marks is an author, writer for The New Yorker, former writer for Saturday Night Live, but obviously they're best known as being the two most accomplished ukulele players since, I would guess, Arthur Godfrey. Tonight at 6 o'clock, who is he? Tonight at 6, they'll be at the Coolidge Corner Theater at an event sponsored by Brookline Booksmith. It is sold out, but standby tickets are available. Roz and Patricia, it's great to see you both. Thanks for being here.
Thank you for inviting us.
So we read a lot about helicopter parents. The New York Times just has a story about snowplow parents who clear every obstacle in the way for their perfect children. And then we now learn a lot of them are cheating to get their kids into USC and UCLA and Yale and all that. These are not, this is not the mothering you're talking about in this book, is it?
Well, as far as I know, my mother never paid anybody to get me anywhere. Maybe that's why I never got anywhere. I don't know.
Well, we were also born before helicopters and snowplows were invented.
Yeah, I guess so. Apparently, your mother wasn't even sure she was there.
They were, yeah. Horse and carriage mothers.
Yes.
By the way, your mother is alive.
My mother is 92 and lives in Philadelphia.
Does she live at the Philadelphian?
She does.
Do you know who else lived at the Philadelphian?
Your
that
mother,
would be me.
You did?
And my mother when I was a little boy. And then we moved across the parkway to Parktown Place, but I lived at the Philadelphian for 12 months. I feel so connected. It is
Can we talk about nothing but that? Where did you go to high school?
I went to Central High School.
My mother was a guidance counselor at Girls High for a little while, and she said the reason she took the job was that she could ruin not just three children, but hundreds.
Well, she did, because I know a lot of the young girls at Girls High, and she was very successful in her efforts. By the way, for those who didn't know, Central High School and Girls High, the Supreme Court of the United States determined, I can't believe we're discussing this, that separate but equal was actually okay in this setting, as long as the boys' school and the girls' school, which were about a block away from each other, were equal. So it was sort of a Brown versus Board outlier kind of thing. So how does she like the book? That's the key. Has she read this thing?
I didn't exactly tell her I wrote it yet. Yes, I did. I kind of eased into telling her. The first thing I said was, Roz and I are writing this book. It's kind of about mothers, kind of about Roz's mother, kind of about you a little bit, and sort of. I mean, not really.
Mothers in general.
Mothers in general. Yeah. And I said, so you have any ideas? Could you help me? It's just the kind of things you said, kind of. She said, well, give me an example. And I gave her three examples. She goes, I never said that. I said, you did. And she said, you're going to make me look awful. And I thought, that's my role in life.
She looks great to me. Your mother is no longer alive, correct?
This is true.
But you're another one. Last time we saw you, was it your last 2014,
when
2015?
When the book came out, Why Can't We Talk About Something More Pleasant? That was what it was called, correct?
Can't We Talk
hysterical.
About Something More Pleasant? Yeah.
And what was the thing that was supposed to be more pleasant that we weren't supposed to talk about?
What we were supposed to?
We're not supposed to talk about.
Basically, the big D. yeah, as in, shuffling off to Buffalo.
Yeah.
And, yeah, so you're just not supposed to talk about that. Illnesses were fine. My mother loved to talk about illnesses and death in a sort of abstract way. Like, do you know what happened to Mrs. Krensky? She died. And, you know, then, of course, my father would say, you know, can't we talk about something more pleasant, which is where the title came from. So.
Which is
for me, it was a little bit the opposite. We did not talk. You were too young to be sick. You could not be sick. We never were sick. Death we didn't talk about, but there was a period for years when my mother called me at least once a day to ask me if I had a will. And at some point, I thought, either you are planning something or you know something that I don't. It was a little eerie how many times she asked me if I had a will. And and I just decided I'd lie. And then I was going for work on a trip to China. And it was terrible, like hair-raising traffic. And I thought, I'm going to be in so much trouble if I die.
That's,
you know,
right.
Can we just kind of do one? By the way, I said to you guys when you walked in the studio that Marjorie, like fools, were laughing out loud.
Yes,
virtually
we were.
Every page.
We were.
I don't know. One of them, there's this unbelievable cartoon by Roz of this woman looking out a window at a rainbow and flowers. Now that's a view. And what Patricia has written with it, that her mother said, when traveling, call the hotel from the airport to say there aren't enough towels in your room. And by the way, you'd like a room with a better view. I mean, it doesn't get any better. That tells you everything you need to know
it's
about this woman.
It's kind of true. The thing about hotels, I mean, if you have the nerve to do that, which I don't, but they start with the worst room that they offer you. And if you're a person that likes the worst room, you're really happy. But if you just say, could I have something better? They go, sure.
Yeah.
Just want you to ask.
Exactly. Well, there's so many great things in here, too. The other one is it's sort of the beginning of the book where you have an unbelievable cartoon of – and the cartoons are just brilliant. They're
Thank
fantastic.
You so much.
This woman sitting in this overstuffed chair that's about three times too big for her and looking befuddled. Everybody always kind of looks very befuddled or very frazzled in your cartoons, which I love. And you say, my mother, and this is you, Patricia, my mother has no interest in the past other than regretting it. And then we have her thinking all these things. We should have bought the Lens house. We should have named you Emily Jane. I should have ordered the duck. In retrospect, I should have brought you up in a warm and loving home. I mean, it's just a riot. It's just a riot.
Are you your mother's daughters? I mean, are you your mother's just a little bit younger? Or, well, in your case, your mother's not with us anymore. But are you your mother, Roz?
No, I'm my father's daughter.
You are?
Very much
What does
so.
That mean? How do you translate that? What does that mean?
He was a very anxious person. And, for example, like, he never learned how to drive. He was just way too anxious. I didn't learn till I was 38.
You're a Brooklyn kid. Are you a
Brooklyn
kid? Yeah. 38?
Yeah, 38, yeah. Don't learn to drive when you're 38.
No.
It's really a bad idea. He was just like everything. He would sometimes chain anxieties, like some people chain smoke. He would chain anxiety. He would just go from one to another. And that's like me. My mother, I think, had a different kind of anxiety, but she always was like, you know, stick with me. She had so many expressions. One was, stick with me, kid, and you'll wear diamonds. I mean, I cannot even imagine, you know, saying that. It's like, stick with me, you're going to wind up in, like, Schenectady. And not that there's anything wrong with Schenectady, but, like, if you're trying to go to, like, the public library on 42nd and 5th, you might not want to wind up in Schenectady. But if you're with me, you will.
I have a little bit of your father because I'm starting to worry if this radio program goes to Schenectady.
Oh, I know. I already is. The minute I said it, I started to worry about it.
We mean Schenectady and hungry.
Yeah.
So
yes.
Are you your mother's? What's your mother's first name, by the way?
Janice.
Are you Janice's kid?
I think I have the worst of both, really.
Oh, that's beautiful.
I have the anxiety of my mother.
That's great.
And I have the fatalism and pessimism of my father. My mother has a lot of good qualities, and I don't have those. I mean, she's an optimist. If she buys a lottery ticket, she thinks she's going to win.
My mother did, too. My mother was always entering the publisher's clearinghouse sweepstakes. My father was much more of a pessimist and a fatalist. It was like everything is going to go wrong.
Yeah, well, my mother was... My father... Well, I'm trying to think of a positive way to say that my mother was not lazy as my father was. But my mother thought if you put on dungarees and you roll up your sleeves, you can do anything you want. And and she also told me nobody needs more than 4 hours of sleep, which sort of ruined me.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, I know this is a book about a mother, but father is...
We can go to father.
Well, yes. I thought it was very interesting when I learned that he wanted you to read at a very early age, which is very commendable. But then he would have you read about the execution of Julius and Ethel Rosenberg, and then you have a wonderful drawing next to it. Baby's first book of Nazi war criminals, which I thought
was
just
proud of not being a censor.
Yeah,
So it was like, here, we're not going to censor you from that. And we went to, like, movies that would traumatize kids.
Like what? Did you go to Did you go see the Julius and Rosenberg movie of them in the electric chair?
That wasn't out at the time. We would have.
So,
but it was also... how old we are. I mean, it was pre-psychology. You didn't, if you yelled at your kids, you didn't think, I'm going to pay therapy bills years later.
Which it was all the time now.
Right?
I could have told my parents that. You know, I think I tried to tell my mother that, but she wouldn't listen. This is going to cost you later.
Yeah, no. And this ended arguments. Why do I have to do it? Because I'm your father. And when you're a parent, you get to be the boss. That was like, I can't come up with anything.
I can relate to that.
Yeah.
So, by the way, we're talking to Patricia Marks and Roz Chess, their latest, which is unbelievably great. Why don't you write my eulogy now so I can correct it? Essentially, the musings of Patricia's mother, Janice. Now, you brought into the studio the cheapest looking ukuleles. I don't mean that in a disrespectful way.
There is one
way.
Cheaper.
There is. I find that hard. Now, you brought ukuleles. I happen to know why you brought them, but I'm guessing the people at home may not know. Explain the ukulele thing in your past, if you can. Well, Roz, starting with you. What's that about?
Well, I think, actually, this story starts with Patty.
Oh, fine. Okay.
I'll then hand it over to you.
Please.
Okay. Two summers ago, I was invited to a wedding that was coincident in time and space and place with the solar eclipse. Mm. And all the guests were invited to bring their instruments. And not that my parents didn't force me to take piano and guitar and flute, but I ended up not being able to play anything or wanting to until I was invited to that wedding. And I thought, how hard could ukulele be? Ordered the second cheapest from Amazon, and it's in the cutest color in the world, which Roz calls...
It's the parakeet of musical instruments.
I think it is,
yes,
actually.
Yes, it is. It's teal.
Yes, yes.
And can you, I know this is a little insulting, but can you actually play it?
Oh, a little, we can, sort of.
Yeah. You wouldn't consider.
We would.
You would?
Yeah. Anyway, we then formed a band that is so famous that nobody's ever heard of it. It's called Ukular Meltdown.
Yeah.
We were the Daily Pukulelis. And we're making a big, big, big comeback because we played in Woodstock, but... We didn't face the right way.
Yeah. I remember that.
You remember that?
Huge.
Yeah.
After Jimi Hendrix did the Star Spangled Banner.
And somehow we had blocked those years out.
So, but now we're making a comeback.
So what are you playing?
We're playing a mother song.
Oh.
We play Public Domain.
Yes, that's our special.
Okay. On your mark, get set, go.
As I do your laundry, though you're 22, remember that I'll always be the boss of you. Did I mention starting now you're grounded? 'Cause all your pot, I found it. P.S. I love you. Must I say it yet again to you, dear, until the day I die, dear? Put down your damn phone. Phone, phone, phone. Elbows off the table. Mouth shut when you chew. Remember that one day soon you'll have kids like you. Never leave the house in that whatever. Eat all your peas forever. P.S. I love you.
Jackson, Ross Chess. What do you call yourselves now? What's the name?
We're the Nuclear Meltdown.
You are. Mm-hmm. That was fabulous. That was really, really good.
You know,
good.
The name of the book we're talking about is Why Don't You Write My Eulogy Now So I Can Correct It? There is a section about funerals in here and concern about funerals and eulogies.
There is?
Yeah, there is. There is. You got the woman standing in front of the coffin, the closed coffin.
Oh, I see. Actually, yeah, cartoon.
Complaining about the outfit of the dead person.
The greatest cartoon in the world.
She did do the greatest cartoon. Yeah.
Yes.
Remember that?
Yes, I do, but you're going to...
Do you notice that we're more interested in talking about the book than you are? Have you noticed that or not?
Show me now what you're going to wear to my funeral so I can let you know whether it's appropriate.
Yeah. Exactly.
Oh, yeah, she was big on that. And being grammatical in the eulogy and where to have it. Now, I did tell when I told my mother the title, there's a pause, and I go, it's funny. People think it's funny. She goes, well, I didn't. You're going to make me look bad. And I go, no, it's funny. And she said, and you said it. And she said, don't give me any credit then. I go, too late.
So you have written the eulogy.
Well, I figured I could just read the book.
Oh, very good idea. Very good idea.
Is Janice doing well, by the way? I feel like I'm connected to her now. She's okay enough?
Yeah. She's coming to the library when we do the Philadelphia
Library. Is she? Oh, the free library? That's fabulous. Oh, that is really fabulous.
But you did say that your parents had a very close marriage and that
very close.
Dad was upset that she might predecease him.
My father couldn't. Well, my mother told my father what to wear and what to eat. And my father just said, you know, if mommy dies first, I'm just going to stay in my room. Not like it was a sad thing, just that's the way it's going to be.
And yeah. Roz, do you remember the cartoon that you created about his dependence on his wife, Janice?
Oh,
they were out to dinner together, remember?
Oh, yes,
they're
yes.
They're both sitting at
do
the table.
Do I like halibut?
Yeah, yes. His wife, whether or not he likes halibut.
Yeah.
I don't know if he should order
it. Hard to keep track of those things.
It's funny because my father was kind of like that with my mother. And if he went against her, I still remember once we were at some ice cream parlor and he wanted to order rainbow ice cream. And my mother said, you can't have that. It's, you know, George, you're going to order vanilla. and he did, you know. So it was this kind of...
Before you go, tell me how you did this. Did you write this first, Patricia, then you did the cartoons, Roz?
Roz and I have collaborated a lot, and it's always suspiciously easy. I had been telling Roz things that my mother said, and she was amused enough that she said, if you get together, whatever it was, 40 or 50 or 80, we could do a book. So I said yes, and then it was easy and fun.
It is a riot, and I cannot say how talented you both are at those ukuleles. That was kind of like listening to a symphony.
It was really good. It was really good.
Yeah.
It's a little fish on the ukulele, too. Look at that.
Yes, so it's so cute, right?
That is really cute. I love that.
It's a parakeet. It's a parakeet of instruments. It's
apparently
turquoise.
It's
adorable.
Are you self-taught?
And you can keep things in it, like your keys and your handkerchief.
Oh, yeah.
Okay, this is going to be a bestseller because everybody's got a mother or everybody is a mother. So it'll be, well, not everybody. You're not, Jim, but females.
Knows
anyway.
A mother.
That's right. Knows a mother. Roz Chast, Patricia Mark's latest collaboration is
called
Why Don't You Write My Eulogy So I Can Correct It? A Mother's Suggestions. Roz Chast is a cartoonist, most closely associated with The New Yorker, and the author of several books. Patricia Marks is a writer for The New Yorker, former writer for Saturday Night Live, and Rugrats, and also the author of several books. They're at the Coolidge Corner Theater tonight, an event sponsored by the Brookline Booksmith. It is sold out, and that is a big theater, so congrats. But standby tickets are available if you want to try to get them. Roz and Patricia, thank you so much.
And, by the way, if you can't get in, either by standby, they're going to be with me tonight on Greater Boston. It's going to pre-tape, so they'll be able to get out to Brookline Booksmith. So you have many options on the Chast Marks front.
Fantastic.
Coming you two up, look like you have no you. Idea you're doing television with me tonight.
No,
is
we
that
do.
A safe assumption?
No, we're just a little unhappy because we thought we were going to wear something different tonight on TV. So that's okay.
You still have
we're
going to
rise
to
above
get your act
it.
Together. Yeah. Nice to see you both. Thanks so much.
Thank you. Coming up, we're going to talk with our education man, Paul Revel, about a weird question in the MCAS and a bunch of other stuff. He's next on 89.7 WGBH, Boston Public Radio.
Welcome back to Boston Public Radio. Jim Browdy and Marjorie Egan here with us in Studio 3, sadly without a ukulele. To go over the latest education headlines is former Secretary of Education Paul Revel. Paul's professor at Harvard University's Graduate School of Education, where he also runs the Education Redesign Lab. Did I say he's the former Secretary? I don't know if I did. He's the former Secretary of Education. Paul, it's great to see you.
Great to be here, Jim and Marjorie, on the strings of that ukulele.
I know. Were they a riot? And yeah. I've got to say, the book is
fall
absolutely
down
a riot.
Funny.
Great Mother's Day gift.
It's brilliant.
Anyway, this was a weird situation, this question on the MCAS. The book Underground Railroad is a great book, which I happened to read. It's wonderful. But this question on the MCAS, tell us what the question was and what happened.
Well, apparently there was a question on the MCAS that was, I think, well-intentioned, and apparently it passed a bias committee review with 15 people on the committee and 10 were people of color. But the question basically asked, as I think we should be asking students, to step into the shoes of somebody with a very different viewpoint than your own. In this case, probably somewhat insensitively, it asked children to step into the shoes of some kind of a racist who was pro-slavery or had a very negative message to raise, and they were asked to speak in that voice. And it raised all kinds of uncomfortable decisions for students because much of what they receive in school encourages them not to think and talk in this way. And then the test was asking them to elaborate in that voice. So I think the idea was well-intentioned and certainly no intended harm, but it was probably a poor choice of a question, so it makes sense that the commissioners moved to scrub it.
Do I understand that they're saying for the tests that are in the process of being graded, which included the question, is this right, that they'll just ignore the response? Is that what they're saying?
Apparently, yeah. They're going to adjust the grade accordingly.
But how does that fix it? I mean, if it turns out, from my scant memory of having taken these kinds of exams when I was a kid, there were one or two things that you really puzzled over that you spent more time than you should have because other things went easy. What if it turns out a kid was troubled by this and spent an inordinate amount of time on it and as a result didn't do as well as on the other stuff as he or she might have?
Yeah,
and that's a problem, isn't it?
Eliminating a question doesn't take care of that problem. So, state testing and testing, broadly speaking, is a blunt instrument. And so there are a lot of faults and shortcomings with it. There are some advantages and opportunities to see and understand issues like equity better. So you take with the good with the bad. But the Commonwealth moved promptly on this. I think reasonable people could disagree. I do think we ought to be encouraging young people to step into the shoes of people with very different viewpoints. But there are lots of ways to have done this without going to this extreme.
So, Paul Revel, we gave you credit, deserved credit, when we were talking to the Senate president about a half hour ago for your work in the 90s when the Education Reform Act came to be to try to create some greater equity between poorer communities and wealthier communities with the help of state funds other things. Well, you did. We read a story in the Globe the other day that suggested to me that the divides on this that have caused all of the players who say we want something to happen, which is everybody, and the reality of it happening can seem to still exist. When we asked Senate President Spilka about whether or not she was optimistic, she mentioned that it was a Chapter 70 working group that got her involved in politics to begin with. She cared deeply about this. She's convinced there won't be a logjam again, that it will happen this year. Is that undue optimism based on history?
I don't think it's undue optimism. I do. I was up on Beacon Hill this morning actually addressing the Joint Education Committee in a kind of background session for the history of education reform and how we got to where we got. And I had a chance on the sidelines to talk with people about where they thought the school finance debate stood. And the impression I got from talking with people was there's unquestionably a sense of urgency to get something done and to get something done in this budget season, if not even before the budget is approved. On the other hand, I have to say the tone up on Beacon Hill has changed in terms of where it was when we started education reform, in which there was sort of a general coming together of various parties with different interests who came from different places and trying to find compromises to get to yes. And there's a lot of extreme rhetoric still surrounding the various versions of school finance reform here, and I find that disappointing.
What do you mean extreme?
Well, I mean, people saying you're either with us or against us. There's only one way to do this. Here's the equitable way. Do it our way, or you're really an enemy of equity. And, you know, that kind of sort of overheated rhetoric and rigidity with respect to there's only one solution to a very complicated problem, I think gets us nowhere. So I've been pushing, you know, and I gave some testimony to the legislature last week in which I basically said, you know, once again, reasonable people can disagree on some of the details of reform and how we do it and what strings are attached, how much money, when it happens. There are all kinds of things that you could have disagreements on. But overall, I think we agree that we need to fix reform, finance reform from where it is, and we need to do that urgently.
You know, I was stunned a few weeks ago. We had Andrea Campbell on, who's the president of the Boston City Council, writing about education in the Globe, and she had written in that article that the Boston schools have enough money, which was really surprising to hear because the picture of the education fight up there features two kids from Dorchester, which, of course, is part of Boston, and you saw these walkouts from kids in the Boston schools saying they need more money. Her argument is that they're spending the money the wrong way and that they're not being bold enough about shutting down buildings and consolidating schools where they need to be consolidated. It was a stunning thing to hear from someone who's a graduate of the Boston Public Schools herself.
Yeah, I mean, most people would disagree with the assumption that they have enough money to do the job that we at the state are asking them to do, which is educate all their students to a level heretofore reserved for the elite few students. I don't think they have the wherewithal to accomplish that. On the other hand, I'm also not convinced that they make the best use of the resources that they have for reasons that you described, most notably, you know, the closing of school buildings, which has taken too much time. So I think they could spend better the resources they have, but at the same time, you know, for example, we saw the Boston Teachers Union recently out in front asking for more nurses and counselors and school psychologists to take care of the growing number of mental health needs that are appearing in the schools and getting in the way of students learning and teachers teaching. So I think there's much more that can be done, but I also think pressure for accountability in terms of how they spend the money is long overdue.
We're talking to Paul Revel, former Secretary of Education now at Harvard. Marty Walsh, when he ran the first time, I'm pretty sure in the debate we did in that round, that with him and John Connolly, his opponent, he brought this up too, his plan to bring universal pre-K to Boston. It's 5 years. He said a couple of days ago it's going to happen in the next few years. There'll be $15 million in the budget over, I think it's a five-year, well, I don't know how many years it is, but ultimately he's going to achieve that goal and spoke to the merits. Why should we believe now that it's any more real a commitment than it was when he stated it with a passion 5 years ago? Or should we?
Well, I mean, first of all, I have to commend the mayor on this. You know, I haven't been bashful at criticizing the mayor
well.
in this show. But I think here the commitment to early childhood is really important. It's hard to do in most school budgets because schools haven't been given authorization to fund early childhood. That's another system altogether. So when the public schools take that on, it competes with their own needs and interests. I think the school system has been piloting this already. They've been spending some money on it and this mixed delivery model. As you know, Boston has its own early childhood program that they run. But they're also now supporting other quality providers who are using some of the principles and guidelines. And they've already been spending some money on this. So what I hear the mayor saying, he's putting $15 million in a trust fund to be spent over 5 years. So that means $3 million a year in a billion-dollar budget. That's a modest increase. On the other hand, 90% of four-year-olds, according to what I understood, are already getting some level of service in early childhood. So what you're talking about is closing that 10% gap and increasing the quality. That's what the evaluation that I read said. But in any event, I think it's a first step, and I think we'd have to hold the mayor and the school committee accountable for in future budgets. Are you sustaining this funding, and are you expanding it to make sure that everybody who needs quality early childhood education has access to it?
I assumed the jury was in on this thing, and we've discussed this, I think, with you before, and I surely do not want to mischaracterize his position, but my guess, you'll know it. Several years ago, when we spoke to Governor Baker during his first term, I think he was not totally on board, and I believe, and correct me if you think I'm wrong, that it wasn't that he didn't think it was a good idea, but that more a higher priority was those early, the third, second, third, fourth years until they're strong, I think was Baker's position. That's got to be first.
That's roughly right. I mean, he was saying, what sense does it make to educate people in the early childhood system if they aren't going to the primary grades and the primary grades are in good working order? Now, the logic of that is flawed. In other words, there's still benefit for early childhood education, even if those primary years are relatively not as effective as they might be. However, you have to say that the Baker administration has been willing to put up money for early childhood education in spite of that early position. So I was critical of the early position. I think there's no better investment in education right now than high-quality early childhood, and I think it was a shame that they didn't take that position from the outset. But they are doing more in that regard now, and I'd hope they continue to
What
do
does
that.
More mean? I have no idea how broad the coverage is, I'm embarrassed to say, on the state
well,
level.
Well, the state figures are much lower than what I just quoted in Boston. So there's a substantial wait list for particularly disadvantaged youngsters to get a opportunity and access. Most of the money that we spend in Massachusetts on early childhood education comes from the federal government. So the state can do more.
I'm sorry. So before we get to my favorite story of the week about education, which is that high school doesn't have to be boring, I just want to ask you very quickly about Betsy DeVos. You know, she was running around trying to say that defend the president's cutting the budget of Special Olympics. There was some confusion because part of Special Olympics is within the Department of Education and part of it is private and it gets a lot of money. But when she was doing this, she got so much blowback that the president changed his mind. I mean, she's sort of become this ridiculous figure in education, I would think. I mean,
Well, yeah, she's been discredited on a number of fronts, and you may have seen where one of our congresspeople has called for her to step down.
Catherine Clark.
On the other hand, in this case, it's clear that she got directive from the White House to put this in her budget proposal.
Uh-huh.
So she was getting blamed and thrown under the bus for the cut when she'd actually argued against it. And what was interesting is when it came out, when the president declared himself a hero and says, we're going to fund this after all. Of course, he's not funding it anyway, because the legislature was going to overrule this as it had in two previous years. But he says, I'm the hero. I told my people, I've overruled my people. We're going to do this. It was his people in the White House who had told her against her argument that we ought to stop funding special education. So she was rightly piqued and expressed it publicly, which was unusual.
Yeah, well, she's a multimillionaire. She doesn't have to worry about work. I just feel like maybe she should see this as not a good fit for her and go do something else.
There was a lot of speculation a while back when she had an injury that she was they were going to send her on her way because reportedly the president's not that fond of her, it didn't
she's
happen.
Still there.
But who knows?
It's not fair to be that. I mean, she is the one who advanced the idea that is long overdue that we should arm people at schools to protect
kids
from
grizzly bears.
Arm the teachers. So this was a great piece in last week's New York Times talking about how lots of kids complain that school is boring, particularly high school is boring. But they did this study and they looked at things like theater and debate teams and other clubs and these elective courses like green engineering and gender studies and philosophical literature and on and on and on. And they found that this was where not only learning was happening, but great enthusiasm was happening.
Yeah, this is done by one of my colleagues at the Harvard Graduate School of Education, Joel Maida, and his colleague. And it's one of these examples where you shine the spotlight on something that's glaringly obvious to most of us from our experience in school, that people get deeply engaged in the things that, where they're applying learning, where they're having some sort of immediate, deep engagement, whether it's in a sport or a musical performance or a theatrical performance or things like that. Those are the areas where we're going deep and where you see the deepest student motivation emerging. And I used to say when I was Secretary of Education, our number one problem in high schools in Massachusetts is boredom. You know, we have so many youngsters who are shuffling through the motions in compliance with a curriculum that they don't really understand how it relates in any way to their future or connects to anything that's alive or moving or relevant in their lives. And what they have focused on in this article is saying, if you want to look for ways to engage students, to get them motivated, to keep them coming to school – look into these extracurriculars. I mean, one of the things that we find is when we eliminate these extracurriculars, our attendance problems go up. This is the reason that a lot of our kids come to school in the first place, is to engage in these activities.
Well, I'm sorry.
I was just going to ask if you have any sense whether a lot of schools are offering these programs. It's often complained about that the Boston school shut down at 1:30 with a very short school day.
It's not just Boston. I mean, in the wake of Prop 2.5, wasn't the essentially the first stuff that was cut was the stuff that was considered non-essential.
Oh, absolutely. Boston has the shortest school day of anybody, in the country.
Boston has a very short school day, and a lot of these things happen after school. And, you know, at the same time,
do they have them in Boston? That's what I'm asking, if they have them in Boston.
Well, sure, they have some of these things. And, you know, there are places that are outstanding. I mean, you have a High School of the Arts, and they do a wonderful job with just this kind of thing, or Boston Tech, which works on technical things, being in school hours and after school hours. But, you know, for example, if you look at athletics, generally speaking, and you look across the country, it's the poorest schools that are doing the most elimination of athletics because they're cutting back in their budgets because they don't have enough money to do the regular program in which they're being asked to, you know, emphasize and maybe overemphasize, you know, performance and basic skills subjects. So we've gotten away from some of the things that are most motivational and important to students coming to school in favor of purely academic, and we haven't expanded the day, as we've talked about many times here, so there just isn't enough room to fit some of these activities. But what they're calling for there is, let's think about what works in the pedagogy of a coach, for example, and how do you bring that same sort of methodology into the classroom, or a theater director or a band director? How do you bring the topic alive and get students engaged in problem solving? How do you put students at the center of the learning experience instead of having them sit there and just absorb from a teacher?
You know, this is one of these things, and with all due respect to your colleagues, and I'm glad they did this, I'm glad it got the attention it did, this is one of these things. I have no experience in education. Is this not obvious to
everybody?
That's
what I said. It's glaringly obvious. It's You're shining the spotlight on the glaringly obvious.
When I was in law school, I know it's not high school, I had no interest in anything I did until NYU, when I went, was the second law school in the country after Rutgers to allow for third-year practice. Now, everybody's got it, where if you're a third-year student, you want to practice in whatever court they have a program in, under the supervision of an admitted lawyer, you can do it. The only thing that ever interested me was that, because of what you said 5 minutes ago, I actually got to put the, quote, learning I had, which was not much, that's my fault, not the school's, into practice, representing people in mostly misdemeanor criminal offenses. The most exciting thing I did in education.
In the debating club in high school?
No, in all seriousness. The only things I ever liked in schools, I'm telling, when I was in a private school for 4 years, when I was in public school, when I was in college, was exactly what you're talking about. The stuff that was on the edges. Right. And by the way, the stuff on the edges.
Weren't you the star of the
often, often
the play?
Often
what was
made,
it called? Cowboy in the Moon.
I wasn't Cowboy on the Moon. Actually, I wasn't. I wasn't the star.
He's
I was
so
the
resilient.
Second lead. I was the second lead in Cowboy.
Second lead.
Edward Mervis, who wore shorts to school, by the way, in the dead of winter. That's a whole other topic. Was the lead in every single. But it's you know, and by the way, funding cuts, as you know, ten times better than I, are what cause schools to decide that the stuff that's not necessary. But that's what makes a kid want to go to school.
Well, no, and we have to get clear on it. And so we're not making policies that sort of support the obvious here. We need to break down the barriers between the high school and the outside world. These young people are practically grown-ups, and they want to engage in work and problem-solving that's meaningful and where they can make a difference and see themselves as important in the world. And that means not isolating them in classrooms and sort of pouring knowledge and wisdom into an empty cup, but getting them out and doing things. And there are schools that have specialized in this and ways of doing it that are very obvious and right in front of us. But we stick with the old model. We got 6 hours a day.
Yep.
We have to
beat
do the academics.
Submission.
We have to get world-class performance in the academics, so we're not going to do anything else. And it's just misguided. But we have to step back and think about it.
I know Paul, what you're in, the Anchorman Club.
No, I was not in the Anchorman Club. I was not...
I didn't know we were going to get a theatrical history of Jim.
I was actually in a number of the school plays.
Oh, there you go.
I was never the lead.
Okay.
But
you were in the chorus?
Should have been. No, I was not in the chorus either.
But this was a motivating factor. This got you up every
morning. Exactly.
Actually, you know, it seriously, it did.
I'm
it
sure
was
it did.
Huge fun.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Paul Revel, thank you very
nice
much.
To see you.
My pleasure.
Former Secretary of Education Paul Revel joins us every week. He's a professor at Harvard University's Graduate School of Education, where he also runs the Education Redesign Lab. Paul, thank you very much. And up next, we just had a trip down memory lane for Jim. I'm going to ask you about high school. Was it a big snoozer? Was it scintillating? Did the debating club, the chess club, the water polo club, the soccer club get you through? Tell us about the extracurriculars in high school that made your day. That's next on 89.7 WGBH, Boston Public Radio.
Welcome back to Boston Public Radio. Jim Browdy and Marjorie Egan. If you're just tuning in, we were talking to Paul Revel, former Secretary of Education, about a recent piece in the New York Times that documents the boredom of high school. In classrooms across the country, the story writes, students aren't stimulated. The learning process is too regimented, too test-based, leaving no room for creativity or autonomy. The kind of curiosity that comes from extracurricular activities, as we discussed, like drama or the debate club, are absent from the average school day. We're taking your calls and asking if this was true for you at 877-301-8970. Was your high school boring? Was learning a chore? Is this currently the case for your kids? And what was the thing, hopefully there was a thing or some things, that broke the monotony, that destroyed the boredom, and then we're actually exciting that made you want to come to school? And teachers, if you're listening, do you feel that you're penalized if you try to be creative in your teaching? The number is 877-301-8970. I am so into this.
Debating club? Were you in the debating club?
I was not in any club.
You were in no clubs?
I was not in high school? I was not a huge... Not in high school, no.
What were you doing?
I can't describe what I was doing.
It was slithering.
I was doing some things I probably shouldn't have been doing, but it was not extra. No, but it's my whole education. I'm telling you, and I'm sure I'm typical of every single person listening to the show. The most exciting things, the things that stimulated me, that made me want to go to school, were the things that were not part of the traditional curriculum, or if they were, they were done in a way, as Paul described, that was much more exciting. Was a hands-on, you know, as much as, for example, everybody. I mean, I was grossed out by dissecting a frog, and I'm horrible in science. I have horrible science IQ. It's the only thing I ever liked, even though I was grossed out by it, because you actually got to do something. When you got to look through a microscope rather than just read or be lectured about something, and all this extracurricular stuff that is cut almost the first thing to go, clubs, sports, all this kind of stuff, are the things that make education interesting.
You know, I think some things never change.
Like
the
what?
Kind of the cool and hip kids. You know what club they're always in?
No.
Photography. Remember that?
No, we
kids
didn't
were in photography. That was
class.
Always really
we
neat.
We didn't have cameras.
And
I was
kind
a
of
kid.
The chess club was a little bit more nerdy. Yearbook club might have been a bit more nerdy. You know, the Latin club.
What did you love when you were in school? It was a while ago. We know.
It was a long time ago.
So
it was millions of years ago.
Well, you were a cheerleader.
I was a cheerleader.
Does that count as like
that? That was sort of the thing. I'm embarrassed to say.
Well, it's okay. I mean, it's an extra. I mean, it is.
I was briefly in the Latin club.
It's what Paul said that, you know, we've quoted David Driscoll, the former commissioner of education, only 10,000 times on the show from years ago when he talked about the fact that the school day, for example, was created when we were an agrarian society, and for the most part, it hasn't changed. Creativity should be encouraged in any way possible. And if you find what I was trying to say to Paul that I couldn't articulate is on the days when I had something exciting to do that sort of outside the norm, it made me able to tolerate the things that were the norm much more, because I knew there was, you know, some great trapping or some great class of the day. And by the way, I'll shut up after this. When I was in college, the courses that I went to were often the courses where I was least interested in the subject matter, but I was most interested in the teaching method of the man or woman standing in the front of the room. I mean, it's obvious.
Theater was a big thing for lots of people. Well, and you know something? You weren't there. You were off the day we talked about Malcolm X's
I was all for that discussion. I came in late, yeah.
And he talked about being on the debating team in prison for the time he was in prison for B&Es and theft and so forth, and how that helped him with his skills going on, because he was obviously a great talker for the rest of his life. Anyway, what was it that got you through high school? What was exciting? What did you love? And how much do you think it matters to have these great extracurricular activities in high school? Lori and Sharon, thanks. Start with you.
Hi, Lori.
Hi.
Hi.
Long-time listener, first-time caller.
Thank you.
I finished high school in 1979.
Yeah. Oh, Lori, we got to put you on hold for a minute. Your connection is horrible. Don't go away. We'll take one other call. We'll come back to you, and hopefully the cell connection will be better. So don't go away. We're just going to put you on hold. Ellen and Melrose, you're next on Boston Public Radio. Hi.
Yeah, hi. How are you two?
Great.
Good.
Good. I had two things. One is I went to an all-girl Catholic school, and there were 1,000 girls in the school, and the only sport we had was basketball or cheerleading. And also, I think they had the yearbook. Mm. And that was really what did it for me. And that was like limited. It was so limited. That was all we had in those days. The second piece I wanted to say was I became a teacher, and my first 2.5 years was class, study and all that, which, you know, you have to do. But junior year, we went out with Mission Hill, actually. We went to a lab school, and we were supervised by teachers, et cetera. And then senior year, we went for half a year. We went to, and I was actually at the Lee School in Dorchester the first year it opened up for busing. And, you know, that was like an unbelievable experience, because a lot of times, like, you learned how to teach, but you also looked around and said, like, you know, geez, I'm learning how not to teach, too, like things that I didn't think was so cool that people were doing. But really about it.
Ellen, thanks for the call. A hands-on kind of thing. You know what I'm thinking about also? I mentioned this the other night on television. I don't know what we were... Oh, the Dark Sky Movement. When I was in college, weren't allowed to
that
take...
That was a neat segment.
What?
With the astronomer.
Oh, Kelly Beatty is great from Sky and Telescope. But putting it aside... not putting it aside, he's great. It is when I was in college, you couldn't take... What are those... you had to take the mandatory courses...
Correct.
...into the second year. And the course that I was waiting to take... I know this is not high school, but it's the same point. I was waiting to take astronomy. And you know why? Because I wanted to look at the stars. And when I got into the first day and got the syllabus for the class, you know what the whole semester was?
Reading,
math, and this kind of crap. And you couldn't even look through a telescope till the second semester. And I dropped out on day one.
You had to be smarter about your choices. I took altered states of consciousness.
I know you did.
In college.
What was your ridiculous major, which has nothing... What was your ridiculous major? Like
American Studies. Was
oh,
a good
that
major.
Was, yeah, that was
American
really,
History, American yeah, Art, like
geography
American
and stuff
kind
like
of
that.
Combined it all together.
Ellen,
oh,
thanks
brilliant.
For your call. Lori and Sharon, we're going to try you one more time. Hi, Lori.
Hi, how's this?
It sounds better so far.
Better?
Yep, let's see.
Okay, so I graduated high school in 1979.
Yep.
And one of the classes that made the most impact on me was my 10th grade English class, Ms. Eldridge, who had two little stages built on wheels in our English class, one higher than the other. And we never knew each day that we came in where the stages would be or how our desks would be set up. And we would be in the middle of reading Shakespeare or whatever it was we were studying. And she'd say, okay, you know what? You two, up on the stage.
I love
and
that.
Bring it to life.
I love it.
Or if we were doing writing, then we would take turns reading our writing from the stage. And it just made the whole thing more real.
And how simple
and
is that, too? I'm so glad you called and so glad you
and
stayed
so
on hold.
And so simple and cheap.
Simple, great. Cheap, and did it great. Hey, Lori, thank you for the call. We appreciate it.
Listen to this. Stephen said this is a true story. My delinquent friends and I had T-shirts made up that said we were on the Vandal team, and we would surreptitiously dismantle small bits of the school's infrastructure.
That's
like
fabulous.
Doorknobs
oh,
and
that's
shelving.
So much fun, I'll tell you.
Yeah, yeah. Okay. Let's go to Olivia in Providence. Hi, Olivia.
Hi, Olivia.
Hi, how are you guys doing?
We're good. Thank you for calling.
So I graduated in 2012 from high school, so not too long ago. And I was lucky to go to a pretty small private school, and when I was growing up, everything that they did, when we studied immigration, we had spent an entire day where we had immigration simulation, and everyone was assigned country, and they got to pretend they were from that country and go through a fake Ellis Island. And we studied, the teachers, we painted pots, and the teachers broke them up and went and buried them on a beach, and we spent an entire day pretending to be archaeologists and
digging
up ancient Egyptian artifacts. And that was all through elementary school. And I know that that just changed the way I thought about education for the rest of my life and just made me so excited to learn when I came into class every day, even all through college. And then when I entered high school, you know, there was a lot of bullying and I was bullied a lot. And, you know, just knowing that you could still love education, what made me want to keep going into school every day, especially on the mock trial team. Getting to sit in front of actual judges and pretend like I was a lawyer just made me feel alive, and it made me feel like I could make a difference. And it actually made me study communications in college and get into politics and all this stuff. So I understand how important it is for students to actually get hands-on education rather than just sitting in a chair.
Olivia, that was a fabulous call. That was great.
Can you imagine
Thank you.
Going to look for things as an archaeologist on the beach? That
no,
would
it's
be
great.
Pretty...
And she was bullied, but she still looked forward to going to school because of the value of these things she was describing. That was a fabulous phone call. Our number is 877-301-8970. Paul Revel said when he was the Secretary of Education, he was saying the biggest problem in high school is that it's boring. There's research by a colleague of his and somebody else in the New York Times saying that is the problem. But unlike a lot of problems in education, which require either a lot of money or a lot of something, a will that doesn't exist, this is something that is right in the hands of the teachers and the students and the administrators. And, you know, just do it, I guess, is what I'd say.
Yeah, one of our staff members said she hung out. She was homeschooled, but she learned how astrology by hanging out with the guy in the neighborhood that had a big telescope. And then when she got to high school, she got an A in astrology because she learned all this stuff hanging out with the guy with the observatory.
Well, her mother said she got an A. We don't know if she really got an A. In any case, I got it, though, Tori. Thank you. Janice in Cape Cod, you're next on Boston Public Radio. Thanks for calling in. Hi.
Yes. Hi, Jim and Marjorie.
Hi.
When I was in the ninth grade, we had an art teacher, and one of our projects was to design an album cover. Back then, people had albums, listened to albums. I graduated in '74 from high school, and that was fascinating. Even though I wasn't a good artist per se, I think I just used. Whatever creativity I have had to do the album cover, and she never really graded you on it. She just thought this is great, you know. You did the best you could, and so it wasn't you know A, B, or C or things like that. And then when I got to high school, I went to Ursuline Academy in Dedham, and it's an all girls school, and there was 300 girls in the whole school from 10th grade through 12th. And we had Mr. D'Angelo for English literature, and he was always trying to get us to think outside the box. We read King Lear, we read Sister Carrie, all kinds of classics. And one day he took us all to Boston to see One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest in live theater. Which was fabulous and scary at the same time because everyone booed at Nurse Ratched at the end, you know, the whole audience.
That's pretty great.
When they came out for their, encore.
Janice, thanks for calling. You know what is the fact that Janice remembers every piece of this from the names of the teachers. I mean, it shows. You know, there was a teacher my kids had.
Don't you remember the names of your
teachers?
Well, you do.
No, I don't remember almost anybody. But my kids had a teacher. His name was Fred Park. He's still in the school system when they were in Cambridgeport, which is, middle school in Cambridge. By the way, he sat in the Clinton box as the teacher of the year in America.
Wow.
The reason I just thought of him, by the way, is because he actually wore shorts to school 12 months a year or 9 months a year, whatever it was. And they came home so excited because he didn't do anything in a traditional way. You know, it just
great teachers stays with you night and day. I mean,
I think
of the great teachers in my life and how much of a difference they've made in my life. That's why I get frustrated when there are bad teachers. But there are so many great teachers.
Well, you're
so,
the one. I mean, people know Miss Crispo, Living Fossil.
Miss Crispo, Living Fossil.
Is one of the finest. What was she, health teachers?
Health teacher.
Now, by the way, she created, and Marjorie wouldn't even know about Rogue Sperm.
I wouldn't know about Rogue Sperm.
Were it not for Miss Crispo, the Living Fossil.
The Living Fossil, that's correct. But I had a great teacher in high school, English teacher, to whom I owe my whole career.
What's
her
name?
Dolores Burns. Her name is, she's
Is that really true?
Yes, she taught, she really emphasized the grammar, and she said you have to write essays for her, and you have to write them until they were perfect. What did I become? I became a writer.
But was that fun, or just...
No,
she,
no. It
well,
was
then it wasn't
difficult.
That she was creative. It just she tapped into something that was in you to begin with. So she's not illustrative of the issue we're talking about. I mean,
no,
if you weren't into writing,
she's not an extracurricular type teacher,
or a creative one. She just tapped into something that was in you.
Well, she was creative in the sense that she made sure we all get drilled on the SATs, so we didn't have to go out and spend, all this money to go to these courses everybody has to do.
Well, also, and I think you have stayed away from what I hear from Rogue Sperm for decades, have you not? Since Miss Crispo,
right. I can tell the regular sperm from the
Rogue Sperm.
And
exactly.
I know,
stay away.
Go the other direction.
Exactly.
Marilyn Boston, thank you for
It's a beautiful story. Actually, it's inspirational. Go ahead, Marilyn.
Hello.
Hi.
Hi. Yeah. I just wanted to say that in high school, I never really liked school at all until I finally got to go to performing arts school, Walnut Hill in Natick, Massachusetts. Mm. Supporter of GDH, by the way.
Oh, great.
And
And now I do a program that you guys are familiar with, Urban Improv.
Oh, my God, yes. Meryl, yes.
Right? Where kids, I know, have said that sometimes they only will come to school because they know that that day they're going to do Urban Improv because it's a fun program. It's something that they enjoy.
That is fabulous.
I feel like And so, by the way, thank you for your support of Urban Improv.
By the way, Urban Improv, we should say,
so talented.
And we should say in May is Band in Boston, which is this fabulous annual program that's done at on Lansdowne Street by the Urban Improv people. Marjorie and I are hosting it again this year. Elected officials, big politicians, big corporate leaders, people sing, dance, do stuff, make fools of themselves, and it is fabulous. Meryl, thanks for your work, and we're looking forward to that, actually. Check it out, Band in Boston, if you want to come. It's a fabulous night.
Squeeze in one more.
Aaron.
Excuse me, Aaron from the South Coast. Hi, Aaron.
Got a minute, Aaron. Hi.
Okay, thank you so much. I work as a website coordinator for a school district down here, and they have one of my jobs as a website coordinator is to write press releases. Today, coincidentally, I'm writing one for a new club, which is Knit or Crochet.
Really?
And it's actually full of people. What they've done is they started a club that not just knits and crochets to de-stress themselves during a certain block during school, but they also have donated what they knit all winter long. They were donating to the Sister Rose shelter in New Bedford.
That's great.
And they produce hundreds of pieces. They have boys, girls, and a wonderful teacher named Senora Carrera. And there's so many great teachers in the school that have come up with ideas with their kids to form clubs. And your callers are right. Sometimes that's the reason why the students want to come to school.
Aaron, so we got to go, but Aaron, we're really glad
time,
you got
thank
through.
Thank you. That was a great call.
That is great.
A knitting club.
I would have done that, by the way. I was knitting, I told you, Raya rugs when I was in law school.
Yeah.
I know you don't believe that. You don't know what a Raya rug is.
I don't know what a Raya rug is.
But let me tell you, they were fine.
Sounds suspicious to
That's
me.
That's why I couldn't go to class, actually.
Yeah, okay.
It's not suspicious. It's nothing suspicious
very
about
suspicious.
It.
Very suspicious. Very slippery. Very
we're
slippery,
done,
Jim.
Thankfully. We'll be back
Thank
tomorrow.
You for listening to another edition of Boston Public Radio. You can find us by way of our podcast called Boston Public Radio on iTunes. Tomorrow, we're going to be at the Boston Public Library. We're going to be joined by Steve Hoffman, head of the Cannabis Commission, Ryan Landry.
Oh, he's back.
Yes, he is back.
Great.
And our Friday All-Stars, Callie Crossley, Emily Rooney, and Shirley Leung. I want to thank our crew, Chelsea Murs, Amanda McGowan, Tori Bedford, Arjun Singh. Our engineer is John the Claw Parker. Jim Browdy, what's on TV tonight?
Well, you're going to get a second dose, but this time you get to see him and play and talk. Ross Chast and Patricia Marks, this fabulous book about Patricia's mother. It is fall down funny. They'll be joining me. And Douglas Brinkley, his brand new book, noted historian, American Moonshot, John F. Kennedy and the Great Space Race. Obviously the 50th anniversary. We're going to talk about John F. Kennedy's race to the moon. And then we're going to talk about another president who says he wants to get to the moon in the next few years. That would be the current one. So Doug Brinkley, Roz Chast and Patricia Marks. Pretty good night on Greater
Maybe
Boston.
Maybe he could lead and go to the moon first himself.
You don't mean Doug Brinkley. You mean
no,
the other
somebody
guy.
Somebody else.
Exactly.
Okay, I'm Marjorie Egan.
I'm Jim Browdy.
Thank you so much for listening. Please tune in again tomorrow and have a wonderful afternoon.